Bobby.
Yes.
Word up.
Word up. Word of mouth. See Kellen, where did it go?
We're at a slow shop here.
You're looking to look actra. Look at that. Yep.
Actors here. Exactly. All the actors come here.
Yeah. Is this an office for actra?
Yeah. Look at that. Actually, it's a union office.
It's going to be all on the blog spot very soon. So we have to wait for Linus Minimax.
Oh, nice.
So you can start talking to me, interviewing me or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah, how's the trip been?
Excellent. 7 weeks in Europe. No, 5 weeks in Europe, 7 countries and 12 flights back to Maui.
Nice.
End of August and then back to Washington to a week later to for Carolyn to get her big award, Excellence in Integrated Medicine. Excellence in Integrated Medicine. And then me up here in Toronto to look at a McLuhan's personal library. You can look at, anybody can go to the Thomas Fisher Rare Book Library and look at the 5,000 books and see what he said about different authors that he engaged, past, present, and way in the past, and the annotations are really good. So I did many days at that library. Yeah, the corner of St. George and Harvard. It's called Fort Book, a huge, tall library. And I spent many days there over the last 2 weeks reviewing what I suspected. And everything I thought I knew McLuhan, what he would say about these books and authors, was confirmed and validated.
Are these handwritten notes? Or
yes, handwritten notes. Handwritten. And you can actually scan them, put them in your memory stick, and don't make money out of them, but you can have them to look at.
Right.
And Bob Logan told me that he has a team that's transcribing all the annotations of all the books. So that'll take a while, but that'll be interesting when that's done. I assume he couldn't sell it unless he makes a deal with the McLuhan Estate, which could happen, and then you'd have to pay for it. But it is a new resource that's inspired Linus Minimax, Bob Marshall. They have a new, unique set of ideas to look into. It'll make Toronto the head of media ecology until we finish it off here. That back in Iron Dome, of course. That'll make media ecology obsolete, but in the meantime, Toronto will be a headquarters for scholars in McLuhan land because of all these books that are available. 5,000 books. So, I've had a great time in Toronto, enjoying my propensity to investigate McLuhan to the max. Plus, I've met with all kinds of people, all kinds of neat synchronicities, taken many people out to dinner. I went to 4 films at the film festival, TIFF they call it now, and
Bill Murray?
No, I came a bit late, so I saw, the only guy I saw was Abel, who did the Pasolini movie, and I caused quite a scene at that director's interview. We'll wait for another time to go into that, maybe. You know, I don't know, maybe later. I don't feel like saying it right now.
What about that conspiracy culture?
Oh, that was a very nice experience. And I was there in October 2007. I didn't interact with Patrick very much. Maybe didn't even know which guy he was. He claims to remember me. He says I've radically changed physically, like, you know, like you can't believe how different I look. I don't know how I looked back then. We know that many people here in Toronto say that I look very young, a lot younger than I did years ago. So Patrick confirmed that by being, I guess, impressed how different I looked, and I assume younger, but that was because I got new cells, new perfect cells. So
yeah, did you mention the RNA drops?
Oh, I grilled Kadena, and
she was there.
Yeah, gave her a special introductory seminar on it. Patrick was too busy doing his books in the last 40 minutes of the store, but he'll get it from his wife, and so hopefully they'll be smart enough to look into it. I told them that you write about it on your blog. You do, you know, last year you did your investigation of drops.
Yeah, I just haven't done an update in a while.
Yeah, have you been getting any lately?
I've been doing some updates on the Rob Ford stuff, but then this is the most shocking thing is that this week, like, the biggest change, or last week, the biggest change has happened.
The day I arrived, Monday, September 8th, he went in the hospital. I fucking removed him from the scene just by showing up, okay? And, and then, you know, it took him a few days. By the end of last week, he announced that he wasn't going to run. Now his brother is running, but we have someone in his camp. You can't escape Dobbstown. It's just by accident. There's someone right there that will keep me abreast of events behind the scenes.
Because he is running for the city councilor position, and so he's probably going to get that. But, you know, he might be in laid up in the hospital.
Oh, is that right?
So, Ward 2. That was his old position before he was mayor. And then he's probably going to win it from the hospital bed. But then, like, if
Doug wins.
Yeah, if Doug wins, then, I guess then they're back in office.
Right.
And Adam Vaughn is now in Ottawa, probably. I don't know if he's there now.
But no, physically. But he got elected, and he's going to be there from now on, setting up Justin Trudeau, and that'll probably end in tears, as they all politics does. And what I had something to say about it. It'd be great if the Fords get back in. Toronto deserves it. This is ridiculous.
That part is the diagnosis, though.
Cancer diagnosis. Like, that's what I was thinking. He should get into the endorse the medical
drugs.
Marijuana.
Yeah, but what about the RNA drugs?
Yeah, if he did the RNA, you go down and visit him. I mean, if Mike Tyson can visit him, the Toronto journalist Daniel Libby can visit him, and you won't cause a big shit on CBC. You won't cause a flap or whatever that station was.
Because people are worried about the chemotherapy.
Oh yeah, but it's useless. But the unless it works, you know, we leave it open. But it's not wise to do the chemotherapy. Do other things first. But what was it? So Greg Duffel showed me the Mike Tyson, whatever that interview was, where he had a tantrum and nailed the interviewer. That was pretty good. That you can't get that on YouTube, but Greg has it. So you can watch it. It's pretty impressive how Tyson sizes him up pretty quickly and then makes him very uncomfortable. Makes the interviewer very squirmy.
Yeah, I haven't seen Greg in a while.
Well, of course not. I mean, you're not actually exactly simpatico, right?
No.
You have different interests. You don't have a fine point of view, and he doesn't like that.
I used to talk to him all the time, though, when the whole thing with CKLM was going on.
Yeah. See, you were spying, though, for different factions. You didn't even know which faction you were working for, but you were friendly to everybody. And Greg is not like that. Greg demands a point of view, you know?
Yeah,
what do you stand for? So edit that part out.
That's like the smog. We got a toxic smog here in Toronto.
Yeah, I've been. Is there really something like that here?
Yeah.
Because I did start coughing a little bit. I never cough generally in Maui, but I noticed I got a little irritated throat.
So what was the 12 cities in Europe?
No, 7 countries.
Seven countries. 12
flights. So, from flying to London and flying back through LA, it was a total of 12 flights. So, maybe 13 if I consider the LA to Maui one. I can't remember if I included that. But I went from Maui to San Francisco to London, then went to the Wyndham Lewis Conference on July 24th, 5th, 26th. Witnessed a rare showing of Enemy of the Stars, gave a talk, As the conference unfolded, there became a big division over me when I would start responding to speakers and panels. If there was a certain faction, they would ignore my hand. They wouldn't let me speak. And I challenged them. They said, well, you're trying to take over the conference. I said, no, I'm not trying to take over the conference. I'm just trying to ask questions and see what you're saying. I have things to say in response to your answers. And then there was the other half. They had swore to me, and they demanded Bob be heard. So I caused division everywhere I go, being the anti-Bob, or the pro-Bob, or the Antichrist, or the Dragon of Babylon, whatever you want to call
me. Did you have any poll in the Scottish referendum? They're saying
that. At it yourself? Are you pointing it at yourself there?
Yeah,
to include you. Do that. What was your question? I drowned it out. Do it again. Point it at yourself.
I was just saying the Scottish referendum, because that's one of the biggest stories like this week. And then now they're saying the votes were rigged. So did you have any?
Who won?
Any poll on that? No. There's still going to be a United Kingdom. Yeah.
Don't bring up another subject when I'm telling you about my trip. Okay.
Well, that's where because you landed in London. That's what just made me.
I didn't even know about that. I don't pay attention to that. And so I went to the Wyndham Lewis conference and was pronounced by Roxana Paredes. She's the head of the pound list. She said I was the liveliest person. I had a lot of synchronicity with her. I asked her, what is she interested in promoting as a professor at the University of Edinburgh? She said, Leon Surrett. I go, Leon Surrett? I just interviewed him a few weeks ago. So we had this in common, so she checked it out, and she's going to transcribe it for the next issue of the Pound newsletter. So that was an interesting side effect. So then I went to back to London, spent a day there, and then I went to Barcelona. And I got on local TV, alternative TV, by accident. That was interesting. And then I went to Cordoba, and checked out some medieval cathedrals and that. Bruce Powell told me to go there. I also participated in Bruce Powell's opening time website at the IN3 Institute, the program started by Derek de Kirchhoff. And so I was part of that, and that should be on YouTube at some point. And so I did that in Barcelona. Cordoba, back to Barcelona, flew to Berlin, spent a week in Berlin, learned all about the city, had never been there before since 1936 when my father and I flew in to see Hitler. And we actually went to the old airport, which is a huge open public park now, incredible, with the airstrip being used by skateboarders with kites, you know, and sail around with kites. But it's very relaxed in Berlin. People sit all over the place, wherever they want, drinking beer. And have you ever been there?
No.
Drinking beer and sitting on the grass or on the road. They'll sit on semi-sidewalk roads in the city and just sit there with their brown bags. Well, I don't know if they have brown bags, maybe, but they could drink easily and no problem. And women are not harassed there, so it's very safe for women to walk around late at night, early in the morning. So that was pretty interesting. So we had a great week with Roxana. She took 129, this is another Roxana, a Mexican princess. And she took a lot of tapes to be, videotapes to be going to museums and different places. And it's like she has 129 items, long, short, different lengths. And she is gradually making great YouTubes out of all this stuff. So you can go on my Facebook and connect with her place where they're all listed as she does them. So then I went to Switzerland and checked out Severo Latrenje's European Graduate School. Spent a few days there. Became controversial. I won't go into that right now. And then...
So you didn't stop in to Matthew's new Swiss lab. Matthew Ricardo's Swiss lab.
No, I didn't have it. That's all bullshit. He hasn't got any money. Blew it. Blew it on various nefarious activities. So, what happened? I better change that. I better delete. Not nefarious. Wonderful activities. Matthew Hurtado is a wonderful person, and he did wonderful things for our company, and he's having a wonderful time now celebrating his good karma from our working with us. And he's a wonderful person. I do not mean he's nefarious. He's a great guy. So, but back to Switzerland. So I spent 3 or 4 days there. Up in a Swiss chalet. I had the chalet, not Matthew. And that was very interesting. I got to interact with Avital Ronell, who's a famous professor in the postmodern POMO world, and several other professors. Severo Latrangi was not there. He had been there the week before, so I missed him. Then I flew to Nice and hung out with Derek DeKirchhoff. That was pretty interesting. Then I went to Rome and infiltrated the Vatican and went to the Sistine Chapel and all kinds of stories about that. Then I went to Paris and went to some museums, including the Pompidou Center. That was interesting. And I didn't know anybody there. So then I went to Dublin, and hung out at the James Joyce Center there for a few days, studied their digital presentation of the map of Ulysses, the book Ulysses. That was interesting. And did a tour, did the walking tour, but halfway through, one third through, I realized I wasn't going to make it in time, so I hired a cab driver to drive me all over Dublin. He took me to the walking tour places, plus other secret places, so that was worth it. Took photos of me in different parts of Dublin. Then I flew to London, reconnected with a young woman that I had met my first night in London 5 weeks ago, 5 weeks before. She worked at the biggest mall in Europe, the Westfield Mall in London. And then I flew to LA, and a lot of Ionettes met me that night. And I took them out to dinner, spent $1,200 on them, and there are eight of them, including Germaine, you know, the fashion. Remember the Renner sisters? They came. And then flew to Maui and spent a week in Maui, did one payday, then flew to Washington and participated in the gala balls and events around the awarding of people like Dr. Carolyn Dean, my bride of 44 years. Great recognition stuff. And that was interesting. Turned a few people of the old guard onto our REMAG and RNA drops. Then came to Toronto, 2 weeks, home to Maui, early next week, and then we'll be back on the air with Payday on September 27th.
And it seems like a secret trip just because you didn't really announce it on
Payday. I did not. There were Ionettes all over Europe that I could have visited, but I didn't want to engage with Ionettes. I wanted to, basically, I had to meet JW in five different countries for maybe a meeting over our issues, what we're doing, our projects, one day in each country. So I would go do other stuff. He'd fly off, and I'd stay in the country and do other stuff. The only Ionette who knew I was coming was Roxana in Berlin. And that turned out to be a great encounter. There were Ionettes, but I did not want to engage with them in this trip. I wanted to do other kinds of things. Basically, I wanted to review Europe and its cultural centers, having not been there in 30 years, a long time I had not been in Europe. I was there shortly in 2011. We went to the Vatican, but that was just strictly business. I didn't get to see much then. So, what else? If you count the plane, so I flew from Maui to San Francisco, then get on another plane, San Francisco to London, then London to Barcelona, Barcelona to Berlin, Berlin to Geneva, then Geneva to Nice, Nice to Rome, Rome to Paris, Paris to Dublin, Dublin to London, that's 10, 11 is London to LA, and then LA to Maui, 12. So yes, 12, I boarded 12 planes in 5 weeks. Then I had to board a plane from Maui to LA to Washington, so that's two more, then one up to here, so that's three, that's 15, and I'll do two more, 17 flights, that's the number of chapters of Finnegan's Wake, it's appropriate. So I updated and replayed Finnegan's Wake 17 phases, 17 chapters, so that's pretty neat.
Yeah, that's a lot of flights.
If the planes don't get screwed up, you know. So it's wonderful getting this sort of mapped out on video, and you can entertain Toronto with my story. Oh, so while I was here, we are preparing an interesting bunch of stuff that we can't really define for you, but I spent the day with Greg going around encountering various people in old CKLN sites. So we started off by going over to Regent Park, where they have the afterimage of CKLN there with Norman Otis Bridgham. So I did some interesting commentary recorded there. Then we were walking towards 55, you know, where the student center is.
Yeah.
Where CKLN had moved to, but that's been removed. So went to the student center, and on the way encountered a homeless guy, and I might tell you what I said to him. And then we met two young women, Ryerson students, I think, who were selling this special coconut milk. So we encountered them, and I engaged them, and they told me if I went over to the Metro store, if I bought a container of it, then they'd give me an extra one. So I went back and gave an extra one, which was given to Greg. But we entertained them greatly. So then we went into Gould, into the student center, and there was a protest. No, there was an activist workshop today about tuition fees. So Greg's not allowed in that building, the student center at Ryerson, but I went in. And I hung out for 15 minutes with the activists there and listened to their issues. And they were discussing political correct problems and this and that. And then I said, anybody know Poonam Khosla? And this guy, he didn't even know what I was saying. It took a long time even to establish the two nouns. So he didn't know her. But then all of a sudden this young woman spoke up and says, I know Poonam. So I said, where is she? And she said, well, I don't know where she is, but I was with her 2 years ago. I said, she at York teaching? And she said, maybe. And I think she said that's where she met Poonam 2 years ago. So that was interesting. We're trying to track down Poonam Khosla. Let's see.
Yeah, I remember you mentioning that name, and then I tried to find out who this person was, and because she had been, I guess, running CKLN.
After Adam, in 87, yeah. For several years. And I met her in New York once around 2007, accidentally just downtown on 14th Street. So she was amazed I remembered what she looked like. So that gave me a bit of an update of her life. So I encountered a few people there. And then we went over to the old CKLN building where CKLN originally was. And actually, we sat in there for a while, looked at the Ryersonian, and my energy started to get drained, and I can't afford that because I got much to do with the rest of the day. Mm-hmm. So we started to get the hell out of this building. It's like, you know, terrible, toxic. So as I was walking out the door, the students were starting to come in, and they heard something they'd never heard before. I said, don't bother going in. There's nothing in there. So I was warning the students, there's nothing in the building. So then that two young women heard us, and they started laughing, so we talked and engaged them for a while. That was an interesting interaction. So that was our second set of young women. And all the young women look great today. I think there's some kind of evolution going on in society compared to people back in the 50s and 60s. So then we took the subway over to, you know, Patrick White's...
New conspiracy culture.
The new... office, which he just moved in August 22nd.
Yeah,
August
I was
22nd.
There.
You were at the opening.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So I noticed in the Facebook he calls you Mang. Is that your nickname? M-A-N-G?
No, that's his slang. I think that's what he calls people.
Oh, Mang. Okay. So you don't get called that.
No.
So on the subway, I noticed these two 15-year-olds, 14 and 15. And one was, of course, they were talking, and then the thumbs start going on one of them, and they're totally involved with your body. So we were on a long trip, so I had time to propose to her, do you think this is a new body or a part of your body? She says, no. I said, well, you have to answer your email and play with it, just like going to the bathroom. You can't not do it. She thinks about that. Then I say a few more sentences. And then she kind of says, yeah, maybe this is a new body or part of a body. So this older woman was listening and laughing because I was communicating to the young kids, which the older woman couldn't do. I don't even know if she was connected to them, maybe. And then the younger girl, she was a bit hesitant to believe any of this stuff. Anyway, so that was another two girls we encountered. So now we've encountered six girls. So then we go to conspiracy culture, and I have a long talk with Kadena. So that's girl number seven. And then there was this other girl that Greg had his eye on when we were going to the subway at Lansdowne. And we actually, she came back where we were trying to get a token, and he got to talk to her. So he counts that as the eighth girl. So we had two girls at the new Ryerson kind of world, and then two girls at the old Ryerson world, and then two girls on the subway, and then two women on near conspiracy culture. So eight women. So Greg, I said, you see how I'm a magnet? And Greg says, you know, I don't think I've ever encountered three or four women in one day. But eight is just unbelievable. I don't think it'll ever happen again. So he was quite.
He's not here. Yeah, he took a lot out of him.
Well, that's why he's not here. It took a lot out of him. Yeah. He knows the pretty women around the town, the hot babes, I think he said, it depresses him probably. So he doesn't like to see too many of them, because he's a happily married person, right? So maybe, I don't know if he's married, but he has a partner, and so.
Yeah, I always got the feeling she sort of didn't like when I called, because I guess I would call a lot, but then I remember sometimes when she would pick up, she'd be like, I guess because she knew it would be a long
time. You mean, well, what depends? What time of day were you calling?
It would be on all different times, actually.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't really ever a set thing, but I would always just try to figure out what was going on, but just because it was a big court case.
Yeah.
That was the sad part, is that he ended up owing money or whatever.
Who, Greg?
Yeah.
No, it didn't. Greg's a hero. It's no big deal on the money level. That's not what it was for. It was community outreach. But so you're saying that his partner would be a little irritated at your calling. You picked up.
Yeah, but maybe that's just how she is. I haven't really ever met her, but all I know is he used to talk about Tanya Kim. I think that's who he had a crush on, a celebrity crush.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, Tanya Kim. So we had a great day today, September 20th. I'll be taking people out to lunch or dinner tomorrow night. Big meeting, reunion, and that'll be $1,000 probably.
The old Club 22.
The old Club 22. Nice. Senior members, not like yourself, young people. The original generation.
And Nelson Thal, I
mean. I had dinner with his ex-wife, Linda Thal. I took her up to the Canoe, which is the 54th floor of the Toronto Dominion Center at 66 Wellington. So we had a great 5-hour time together, and I caught up on all the great things she's doing and the silly things Nelson's doing. You know, Nelson is a complete embarrassment to humanity, you know. So that's my only encounter with Nelson, and the world now knows that I get together with his ex-wife every now and then.
What about today? This is a closed shop here. I notice there's a place across the street, but it looks it's like a downstairs. It's like Noir or something? No, Nero.
Right, but we can check that out.
It's like for a dark and stormy night.
Right, but we could go there, but there's other places because there's all kinds of things as you go south.
Yep.
But we're waiting for Minimax, and where is it? Did he come by before you?
That sounds like a name from Five Bodies.
Yes, no, he is. Yeah, Linus Minimax or Ad Absurdum. They're two different names, and he is often on the chat line of Payday Saturday night under that name or other names. But you certainly have, if you've looked at Five Body, he's certainly a long-standing contributor to that marvelous forum.
And when you were in L.A., was there any James Martinez appearance?
Yes, we always go to the Le Hermitage restaurant on Burton Way in Beverly Hills, where there's a portal, and if you're observant enough, look, it's starting to rain a bit. Walk into here. If you're observant enough, you will notice people going into the washroom of that restaurant and not coming out. And we have several people observe this pattern, and there's other stories we've discussed on Payday about the place. So I had my dinner there, and then after we finished that, about 2 in the morning, Corbin had an idea where James lived. So we went to that area, and we walked down the back alley, and I picked out an old lonely motel, that might be where he is. So I went up and knocked on windows, 2:30 in the morning, to find him, and you can go on YouTube soon and see how it turned out. All right, so we were tracking James down. He owes me money, and now that he doesn't talk to me, I make him pay me back. I wouldn't have if he was still a friend, but he's laying low for some reasons.
Oh, that's what's going on.
Oh, yeah. He's avoiding Iondome.
What channel would this be on? It's on YouTube.
I don't know. Maybe Roxanne will put it up.
Oh, she filmed it?
No, Andrew did, who's a regular on the show.
Oh, nice.
He lives in the LA area. He won't have a channel, so that's a good point. I don't know what, who will put it up or where it'll end up, but once it's there, it doesn't matter what channel, you'll find it.
Yeah. That'll be interesting. And I guess we'll see if we get another.
Are you stopping?
Yeah.
What are you stopping for? I'm dancing.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. You don't need to stop. Did you miss the dancing? Did you miss the dancing?
I've got some of it.
Okay. Well, are you stopping?
No. There's the big parties at Young and Dundas. That's where they're dancing, but it's probably over by now.
Who?
It's the Manifesto Festival. It's the big like hip hop festival, but I think it ends around 10.
Oh, okay. It's been on for a few days?
No, it's just one day. It used to be a few days. Now it's just they've narrowed it down to one day. It used to always be Sunday too, but now it's always be Saturday.
And what is the manifesto? One manifesto?
Yeah, it's a Manifesto Festival of Community and Culture. They used to have it at the Naperville Square, but now it's at
Sounds like the small press affair or something like that. But so they have one manifesto or many manifestos?
Yeah. No, it's one festival, but then they have different nights. Like they've got like an art night that was like Thursday, but now like when it started 8 years ago, it used to all be free, and now it's like different stuff you got to pay for. And it's just one of the festivals. There's a bunch of them going on right now. Actually, there's Word on the Street, and there's the one. There's a new one at Fort York because they're just opened a Fort York building.
Is Word on the Street the small press?
Yeah,
there?
I think that's the small press. Yeah,
but so they. People make manifestos in the Manifesto Festival? Or what?
No, I think they just... I don't totally know why they call it that, but it's just a hip-hop festival. So they bring in, like, hip-hop artists, the local ones, and they bring in a few from international ones to bring the crowds in.
Who is the guy that used to be at CKLN? The dub poet? I went on and was a commentator, maybe on CBC. I don't know, that may be too far back for you.
Yeah. I remember there was Dwayne Morgan or something. That was a guy.
Well, there's Lillian Allen and
Norman Show.
The older guy. Clayton something.
Then, Clifton Joseph.
Yeah, Clifton Joseph. Would he be there? Would he be at this thing?
Sometimes, yeah. I've actually seen him at some of these events. So. I remember seeing him at, I think, the art show a few years ago. The one that's at Dundas Square is always just like thousands of people, so it's hard to find,
Well, I met Clifton in 2007, October 2007, at the Milton Blake Memorial. And what was interesting, back in 92, I was in the world's biggest bookstore. I was no longer at CKLN. I was getting ready to go to New York. And Clifton Joseph comes by, and I'm reading The Replacement of Nature by William Irwin Thompson. And just looking, reading it in the store, and he comes by, we get talking, so I say, come with me. So I walked him across the street from the world's biggest bookstore to HMV, and there was Bosmy Ecology decked out in the front windows. All right, Jerry Belanger or somebody, or Nelson, got it prominent. So I'm showing Clifton Joseph this album, which I'm featured in, and he couldn't believe it. He was shocked. I'm like, what? Well, how did Bob, you're just an idiot at CKLN, how could this happen? So I don't know how I explained it, but I remember that was my last encounter with him in 92. He had to walk away dizzy because, he thought he was an album kind of guy, rapper, but my stuff got out there before his. So I meet him, 10, 15 years later. And this was being the HMV window because the album came out on October 22nd. Came out in April 22nd, 1992, so it was probably in the windows in May 92. So 15 years later, I meet him at Milton Blake's Memorial. And first thing he says is, sorry, Bob, I have no more conspiracies. I'm not up in the conspiracies. There's no new conspiracies for me to tell you. And then I started explaining to him, well, I'm not limited to conspiracy information. I have lots of other stuff. But then someone came along and interrupted him, and I didn't get to reinforce the point that that's rather a limited view of me. And I'm now, 7 years later, putting it on record, the incomplete conversation. I'm completing it right now, Clifton, so you know what I would have thought about your statement You didn't know then, now you know. All right? So that's Clifton Joseph. So what we ought to do is I should go phone ad absurdum to see what's happening. Because if he's not coming, we don't want to stand here forever. No. So you can stop the recording. And I'll be back in a minute.
Okay. Okay?
Fucking space cadet.
This is the Green Flag. This is the GFL Green Flag.
Some of them they got totally automated. It's just a big arm comes in and picks up the garbage.
So you, so you're filming again, taping. What can we talk about now?
So this is what this area is known as, like the, what she call it, Boys Town, or it's like a Rainbow Village.
Well, that was one of the people I met with this past 2 weeks. I even invited him out tonight, but he wasn't sure if he could make it. Was Dan Bazin, who started This Ain't the Rosedale Library with Charlie. I don't know Charlie's last name. And that was a bookstore along Church Street here. And they were the first to offer gay and lesbian literature. So they were a big influence in legitimizing or something with the post-Stonewall movement. And people used to think that Charlie and Dan were gay, but they weren't. They were Americans, but they weren't gay. They had, you know, heterosexual partnerships. So talking to Dan is very interesting. How he appraises the world today and the art world, because he's been active in it for 30 or more years. And he was telling me that it could be that I am the greatest artist alive today. He's seriously considering the notion, because he knows the art world is boring and dead and dispiriting, and I'm the only one doing something new that actually might make you feel better. So I'm thinking of starting having some dialogues with him, record some talks with him, and he's a bit shy about it, but we might do it. So that was interesting, encountering Dan. I hadn't spoken to him since 1994, 20 years.
Well, so I've been reading this book. It's called Hidden Dangers of the Rainbow. And it's an exposing the New Age conspiracy, I guess, more of like a, they take like the Christian point of view of like the scary part of the New Age, and then they talk about the Benjamin Krem guy a lot.
Yeah, I know about him.
And then they that's what they mention, is that this Maitreya guy is like a Lucifer that they're trying to bring back.
I guess
it
was the 80s maybe.
Yes, no, Krem's been doing this for 30 or more years. I heard him maybe on Jane Hotton's show on Q107 in the late 70s, early 80s. Talking about Jesus in the Pakistani or Palestinian community in London, I think, was the first place. But this is all silly stuff, because they're just talking about the ship, the chemical body, and a little bit of the astral body. They don't deal with the ship body and the TV body. They have no clue about, you know, Second Coming already came and went. And the successful after image of that is Iron Dome. And these people can't take our stuff. I mean, we're not New Age, we're not Christian, though Ion is an expert on the Bible. Partly he inspired the Bible writers, or they, Ion inspired, and Ion inspired New Age and Gnosticism and the counter to Thomas Aquinas. So we're the experts on what this guy's trying to write. Now, if he heard us, the test would be, if he just thought we were anti-Christian Gnostics or New Agers, he'd be all wrong. And we would demand that he listen to 68 hours Book of Revelations, find out what the Bible and what being a Christian is all about. But, you know, to be a true Christian today, you have to be a conscious quadriplegic. That's the only way, in simple terms, you say yes to everybody. Right? Say yes to everybody. Everybody's 1/10 correct, 90% wrong, and limited, and going to die. We operate from the principle that we're not going to die. You can't die. The hardest thing to do is to age and then kill yourself by suicide.
Now, is there a part of that that's in the Christian part where it's like you gotta, or if you're eternal or whatever, you live forever, right?
But they think in heaven, not the physical. And that's not a limited 3D visual space physical. It's an expanded physical, and the Christians might agree with that. But they are operating on a very strict rules and regulations. real ascension has nothing to do with rules. Now, this could be him. There he is.
There he is. We're on the right track. Mr. Linus Minimax.
You want to get his entrance here? Linus Minimax.
And Edizer is making his entrance here.
Well, that took a long time.
Did you get stranded in the subway?
Yep.
Yeah, the manifesto, hip-hop. Right?
Manifesto?
Well, why did the subway get stopped?
Oh, it took a long time on the streetcar getting there, and then it was telling I was going to take it around the horn from St. Andrew, but then it said between Union and St. Andrew.
Blocked.
Shut down. But,
oh, okay, that explains it, because we just called Kenzie, and we didn't know where you were and what was going on. Yeah. So, should we tell Kenzie we found you? Did that ease
your
mind?
Oh, she'll be fine.
What?
Oh, okay. She knows I'm fine.
Okay, great. So this other guy didn't come, so that's not going to happen. So this is closed.
Yep.
So we got walking up here the other night.
Might
have been last night. 2 a.m. And I hear this smacking. And I look up and there's a black guy and a white guy just fucking kissing, like right over there. And making an incredible amount of smack noise. Yeah, snorting, kissing. And,
oh, wow.
It's fucking gross.
Yeah, this is more of a chill park.
I haven't seen this. This is brand new. This
just
whole bus stop.
Chill in the park.
Bikers.
Chill in the park.
This is the new Toronto of the last 3 years, man. Look, he's impressed with this.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, it's like a
The Rainbow Bridge.
You remember that, David?
The park?
No.
This used to be where we'd, we'd score way back in 98.
16 years ago, man. So what, are those free bikes for the bus?
No, you gotta rent them.
Yeah.
Sponsored by Citibank.
That park looks a lot less seedy than it used to.
Yeah.
And it looks like it's closed anyways.
Isn't that incredible? That Lewis writes his thing on the Pink Millennium or something. It's incredible how he picked up on it, right?
Yeah.
Not even one section, just one page.
Sitting on the ground.
On the ground of the subway station. So I picked it up. It had something else to read. And it includes this guy's column. And it's about István Kántor, the artist... Neoist guy from Toronto, aka Monty Canson.
Oh, yeah?
He was in the news again. He made a bit of news recently. He did one of his trademark, like, he does these, like, interventions. István, who sensed that the doctors did not believe he was an artist, made sure they looked him up on Wikipedia. Doctors also took, oh, necessary irony, a blood test. A young psychiatrist asked him a series of questions. And it is the quintessence of the artist. And he is not wrong.
Yeah. Wait, did he say he is not wrong? Or you?
Sorry, the columnist added he is not wrong. So that's pretty funny.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Excuse there, but narcissistic personality disorder.
Sound. Well, are you taping that part?
Yeah.
Yeah. And,
Better make a beaver instead. Change the location.
Make what?
Better change the town.
Oh, yeah. No, Mike's a public figure. He does some festival in the summer. Some fringe festival or something. Film? No, more film. Video or something. He does some kind of festival in the summer. Look at his address or his name. He mentions the festival.
Well, look, Dave is still there. There's an arts and crafts festival.
No, Dave is very involved. I've been with him twice the past 2 weeks, and he'll be here there tomorrow night. Dave is making music for Carolyn's show, intro for the iTunes version. No, that's no big deal.
I'm sorry.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'm ready.
Yeah. No proof. So, Neufeld, he came to the dinner last Sunday, and he came to the Bruce Powell lecture on Thursday. And then he'll be at the dinner tomorrow night. If I saw nobody in Toronto, I would see Neufeld. I mean, He is Dobbstown North.
So how did the CKLN, how did you get involved with CKLN, I guess, the Raiders?
This Dan Bazin guy, this St. The Rosedale Library, is part of it. I used to go to this St. The Rosedale Library. They opened in 79, so 79, 80, 81, 82, I would go buy books there. They would have the Black Sparrow books, the, I don't know, whatever books that were fringe in the early 80s when you guys weren't even born. They would have it all, and underground comic stuff, all that stuff coming out of the 70s, you could keep up with it at their store. There were two Americans from Grand Rapids, I think they said Michigan. So, somehow, okay, I'm listening to Mae Brussels' recordings, and I meet Bob Marshall on October 29th. It's in the diaries, 1983, at Bob News Party at 242 Queen Street, and I get him interested in Mae Brussels and LaRouche and everybody, and I'm talking to Charles, not Dan. Talked to Charles at first more than Dan, in early 84 or something, and I'm mentioning the Mae Brussels recordings, and he says, well, you know, you could play them on CKLN. And I said, what's that? And so he explained the Ryerson radio station, which at that point was still 13 watts and almost like part of the closed circuit way it was before that, very small and tiny. So so I looked up CKLN and called somebody, and I think I got John Jones first, maybe Chris Toomey. So I had just acquired Mae Brussels Buddy's library, 5,000 books. Lily, she was a fellow researcher with Mayo in California, and they'd go around to use book sales and buy up these books for years. They've been doing it. So she died, and May wanted to know if I wanted the library. So I bought it. So it was trucked over to me, and I got it in January 84. So I'm now educating Bob Marshall at that point. You can read in the diary entries about LaRouche, Mae Brussels, Beater, Zappa, McLuhan, and all this stuff. And I realized, let's get Bob on the get Bob Marshall on the radio. So I called up CKLN, and John Jones came over to my place. And the first thing he did when he got into our living room, he turned on my stereo to see what radio I was listening to, you know, to find and spy on me, sort of. And it was right on 88.1. It was probably put there about a week before. And I forgot to, maybe I would go over to Q107 or something during the week. So it just was right there, 88.1. And he was very impressed with that. But he didn't know that I hadn't really heard it. I was just starting to sort of find out, what is this place? And so I passed that test. So then he said, well, bring... Then I showed him my library, which I had just gotten. Now this would be... This might be May, June, that late into 84. Because we get on August, last week of August 84. So if I go back and look at the diary dates, I'm gradually preparing Bob for the idea of being on the radio, which he doesn't really want to do. So John Jones checks me out. I pass the test. Then I give him a copy. And then the library looks impressive. Looks like I'm a great researcher. And I just got there a few weeks before. So he takes a Mae Brussels cassette and goes down and plays it for probably Anton Leo and maybe Chris Toomey. And he calls me up and said, this is really great. This is something we need. We don't have this kind of news in our news station, news show. But we can't play the whole hour. You're going to have to summarize it. So I said, sure. So in August, we went to, Bob and I went down and... We had written out sort of a summary of a Mae Brussels tape, and so he goes into the studio and reads it, but he's not very good at it. Even though he's an actor, he just felt awkward in front of a microphone. Back then, people would get paralyzed in front of the idea of broadcasting. So it had to be better. So I think... Bob, we decided that he would sort of just make it more casual. half have a script, half read it, half talk it, and not have to say, well, this happened, that happened, this happened, because that's too boring. So he recorded one that was acceptable, so he went on started the International Connection last week of August 1984, and that was the week that Johnny Carson, who's the gay writer? Truman Capote died that week.
Do you? Yeah, he's like the only quasi well-known person I share a birthday with since Rumi.
Right, and what is that, September what?
30th.
So, he dies a month before his birthday, last week of August, at Johnny Carson's ex-wife's home. Whoever she was, I can't remember her name, but it was her place. He was hanging out with her. So I remember, I wonder, what does that mean? You know, I always look for symbolism. And
yeah, it's a pretty big literary figure.
Why did International Connection knock him out? Why did we kill him? Why did he get killed by us showing up in the airwaves? So we broadcast that week. What did it say about it? And then we were down at the station within a week or so, and we met Ralph Ben-Murgi, who was the news director. Now, we might have met him right around the time we were first making the recording auditioning, but it turned out that he was only there for a couple of weeks. And he said he heard the Bob Marshall first entry, and he said, you guys need to put more atmosphere in. Have yourself walking up into somebody's house. So he thought we'd be interviewing people and doing regular journalistic stuff. He didn't understand, no, we're not going to do anything. We're just going to take May Brussels stuff, summarize it, and put it out.
Yeah.
May is better than any atmospherics that you might want to create. And he's expressing his Ryerson training, you know, make interesting atmospheric radio. So he told us that and then said goodbye. And he went off to Winnipeg, start his long trek to CBC status. That's what the Ryerson students would do. They'd move into CBC. And he eventually formed a talk show. He had it. A evening late night talk show. Do you remember the Ralph Ben-Murgi show or whatever it was called? And Anton Leo was his producer, maybe executive producer. So Anton had been at CKLN. He was a station manager when we first showed up. And they leave by spring 1985. So there's a battle over who's going to be the new station manager. And John Jones was the program director. Do you know all this stuff? You've never heard this history.
Some of it.
You're nodding, but as if you know it.
No, I just was anticipating you were going to say 1985, that's when Adam Vaughn takes over.
Right. So I remember one day, maybe in late 84, there's this guy going through the filing cabinet, and I was just outside while Bob was recording the latest International Connection, and Adam starts talking to me, and he says, I don't know. I said, you know, what are you doing going through the files? You're not a programmer or something. I don't know. Something forced him to speak to me. But I realized he was actually down there spying on us and wanted to talk to us. So he volunteers that he is interested in becoming staff or something at CKLN, a programmer, because we inspired him. He had been ill that summer and he had crust over his eyes or something, some kind of weird thing going on. And he was in bed all summer, so he had nothing to do but listen to CKLN, so he caught us pretty early. I mean, that would be August, September, October, so maybe it was more the fall he was sick. And he said this is just because of our kind of information that he wanted to be part of it. So he came down to the station and started volunteering, or I don't know what he did. He didn't have a show, but he was around, so I noted that. And then in May 85, Reagan went to Bitburg. I don't know if you guys remember this. This was a German cemetery where there were a lot of Nazi guys, and Reagan went and honored somebody else in there. But it became a huge scandal that Reagan was honoring Nazis at Bitburg. And this was a big thing in the May Brussels world. So the Nazis were, and they also released in around there somebody's memoirs, Mengele's memoirs or something got released. And so Adam calls me in, or Bob Marshall, can't remember who first, and says he has just become station manager and he wants to make International Connection a Saturday show. Well, it's going to be still the short 10-minute shows on Thursday and 10 minutes on Friday. And it featured Mae Brussels and Sherman Skolnick, and then Dr. Beter and Sherman Skolnick. The second Sherman Skolnick would be a joke or skit that Skolnick would do. The first Skolnick would be news connecting dots, similar to Mae Brussels. And then Peter was the wild stuff. So Bob would read the transcripts of a Peter recording. So Adam's saying, we want you guys to be on, well, not we, you, Bob Marshall. He said, I don't know who you are or whatever, but Bob, we want him on Saturday. And we're going to go into each of your people, Mae Brussels, Peter, Skolnick, LaRouche, and others, Walter Bower, in depth. We'll feature them and we'll do a whole hour on it. It'll be a discussion. And he may have told me that the other people could come on or something, so I got Nelson Thal to come on. Nelson was just into studying that stuff at that point. And so he decided, since he was a rich kid, and you think of the comic book Richie Rich, remember that little comic book? So he called himself Tom Rich with that in mind. So it was Bob Marshall, Tom Rich, and Adam, with Dave Neufeld doing the engineering. And Dave maybe wasn't a news director at that point, but he was going to be pretty soon. So we started doing a Saturday show with Adam through June, July, August, September. Went up to about April 86 with the Chernobyl. It was around then that we stopped. Tension started to build between Dave and Adam over don't know what. So,
did you get the feeling that Adam Vaughn believed in the conspiracy stuff when he started listening to you guys?
I liked Adam at that point. He took us seriously and he wanted to promote us. And I thought, well, geez, none of the other kids there his age was even cared about what we were doing. So he was a friend of mine. I considered him an ally. And he asked me, I remember asking me my opinion, or Bob Marshall's opinion. But it's often Bob Marshall, Adam would say something to Bob Marshall, and then Bob would come to me and ask me, what do I say? Because Bob was just a Pygmalion. He was just a guy that just could read the stuff, like an actor. And he was shy about the publicity. So we told Adam, Adam asked if we thought Neufeld would qualify as news director. And we said, damn right he would, because I knew Dave would support us. He was the only other guy. Him and Chris Toomey had us on your show, Word of Mouth. We had Mae Brussels on in a couple weeks after we started in September. And then he had the Church Sub Genius on in October 1st. And that was the first time I was on the radio, October 1st, 1984. And you can hear that in my timeline. It's amazing. I put every idea possible that I would develop through the years all crammed in there in about 25 minutes with Nelson and James Kidney. And that we figured back then we'll never be on the radio again. So put it.
James Kidney, you heard about lately being on Fringe?
Yeah. James was a member of Club 22 at that time. He had played Lee Harvey Oswald in a play with Christopher Plummer's daughter, which Lee Plummer or whatever her name was. She was an actress in Toronto, and she played Marina, and James played Lee. Now, how I met them is he was a patient of Carolyn's. So he was talking to Carolyn, this is when we lived at 22 Kenwood, about he had to do this play and play Lee Harvey Oswald. And Carolyn said, well, you should talk to Bob. Why? Well, he's got the Torbett document. So one day, we lived upstairs. One day, I'm in the living room, and I noticed there's a guy in my bathroom. So he finishes shitting or pissing, and I said, what are you doing up here? He said, well, Carolyn told me to come up. I'm interested in talking about the Torbett document. I said, oh? So then he came in, and we talked, and then I gave him a copy, and we became sort of semi-advisors to him as he developed the role and went to the play. So James and I became friends. And that's just before I met Nelson Thal. And that Nelson was in May, June. James was probably March, April.
What's that document?
The Torbett document was the main source for Mae Brussels' understanding of the JFK conspiracy. It's actually a book. It probably is in Patrick's store, where you could get it. They finally made it. No. The Torbett document was only available by Xerox from the guy who wrote it. You'd write to him and get it. But it became a published book 10, 15 years ago. I bought a copy when it came out. Maybe there's an intro about it. Have you seen it?
I've just heard about it.
Yeah, no, it is the doc. It is. But it might have a little intro. It's not a book about it. It is it.
It's about the variant of like 5 different spheres of the types of connections. jurisdictions that are involved in the whole thing?
Yeah, the mafia part, the Las Vegas part, the Teamsters and mafia part, and the Nazi part, the White Russians. It slanted towards some kind of Nazi combine that worked with the mafia that supported May's scenario, but she was actually influenced by it. So so he read the Torba document, and I gave him a handle on how to do Lee Harvey Oswald a bit more edgy. So a year later, year and a bit, we're together on CKLN, word of mouth, doing the Church of Subgenius, and I'm Bob Dobbs, and James is like Bob Fox, and Nelson is Bob Locks, or vice versa. One was Fox, I think, and one was Locks. And it's very funny what we do. And James can do Jack Nicholson, so he turned into Jack Nicholson halfway through it. Have you heard this, Daniel? You ever listen to that? What?
Maybe, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
That would be one of the ones that come up in the Studio C every now and again. I don't think I've heard that.
Yeah, no, they'd cycle through all my stuff. That would be in there. But you can just go to the timeline, go to October 1st, 84, and hear it. And you hear Chris Toomey. We play a good chunk of Church of Subgenius stuff. And then we come on and do a satire or something on it, you know. But how it happened is that Chris Toomey came up to Bob Marshall and said, "Do you know anything about the Church of Subgenius?" This would be after word of mouth, May, Brussels, September. So with a few weeks later, Chris Toomey sees us there. He was almost program director or something, but I don't think he ever fully got that officially. But he was around and very knowledgeable about all kinds of stuff and avant-garde stuff, and a longtime friend, childhood friend of Dave Neufeld. As a matter of fact, when we played on the first week or so of word of mouth in September, we played a May Brussel hour. After it, Chris Toomey went into the studio and someone had called in, and you could hear the conversation on the speakers. It was Dave Neufeld, who happened to hear the show and called up and said, "Man, that," and he was a budding journalist at Ryerson at the school, and he was totally amazed. He was smart enough to be very impressed with Mae Brussel. Yeah. "Who is this lady?" So he was asking stuff. I don't know if I got to talk to Dave then, but I noted that this guy called in and talked to Chris. And then it was in the spring of 85, many months later, that Neufeld came up and introduced himself to me and Bob. So that's our friendship started. But he was the first to respond that night. And then, what was I leading to? So we do the... So Chris Toomey comes up to us and says, "I got a letter from somebody." He says, "Do you guys know about Church Subgenius?" "Yes." This letter... So he gave me a copy, and it's somebody demanding that Chris play Church of Subgenius stuff on, just play it on CKLN, the cassettes. And so I read it, and I said, "Let me take care of this." So I wrote a letter to this, whoever he was, I don't know who he was, and said, "I'm the King of Canada, and this is my territory. We're not going to have anybody else do Church of Subgenius. I'm going to present it." So I have a copy of this letter, a totally insulting letter, sent to this guy, telling him to get the hell out of the country. We're just making...
I posted that on Five Bodies at some point, and I seem to remember seeing... I saw something like that.
Maybe. We might have scanned it in.
Similar.
We would have had to scan it in.
Like, Canada's
our territory. And I'm taking over.
Yeah.
And so Chris, I showed that to Chris, and he sent it to the guy, and then that's when Chris said, "Oh, you're involved with the church?" I said, "Well, I inspired it," and then he put us on October 1st. And then in November, there's on the timeline, November 84... we do a special on Marshall McLuhan, me and Nelson, and play a lot of good recordings. So you can hear that. So word of mouth had us on three times. And then Dave became news director, I guess, in 85, and ran the news wave for a year or so until Adam fired him after the tension around Saturday International Connection. I don't know, maybe there's a jealousy thing there between Adam and Dave for my affections or something, not sure.
Well, do you think they got to him, like he stopped, they convinced him to not believe in these conspiracies or whatever? And then
no, it was totally personal.
Yeah. There was something in the diaries about,
Adam Lund doesn't tolerate conspiracies.
No, that's
about, like, no LaRue.
That's Bob Marshall. That's firing Bob Marshall in 87. This is... Dave running Newswave when it was 13 watts, and in July 86 we went to 250 watts, and Dave now was going to have this new news show, which he was putting a lot of time into while being a student, and we were going to have a bigger audience. So he was all excited. Well, the week before we went 250 watts, or the day before or something, he got fired. And at that time, we were getting ready to, with Nelson and I, Adam Vaughn, who had met McLuhan through his father. His father lived near Wychwood Park. Adam grew up there. So McLuhan would often be in Colin Vaughn's home. So Adam knew Marshall as a kid. And he was fascinated about what we were saying about McLuhan. He never heard anybody talk about him like I did. So he said, "Oh, let's do a special series on Marshall McLuhan. You bring in your tapes." So we started to do that. And we got one or two done. And they bought all this new reel-to-reel tape on, you know, on a budget with no money. So they invested in it. And then he fired Dave. And I said, "It's not a bad move, Adam. We're pulling out. We're not going to do the McLuhan thing with you." So that pissed him off. So that was the end of our friendship. And Dave went and got a gig at CIUT. And then we did our special McLuhan series for CIUT and gave it to Dave. And it was more Adam and John. I remember John Jones buying the reel-to-reel tape or something. So it was more Adam and John. They were really happy about having this McLuhan archive. It would be a special thing that CKLN would have. But they blew it. So Dave ended up getting it. And they had all this reel-to-reel tape that they bought. So John Jones and Adam were mad at me and Bob Marshall after that. So Adam goes another year. And in March, in May 87... Bob Marshall plays a Dr. Beter tape, some segment, which goes into Zionism and that. And Adam, we joked about it, he got on the streetcar, ran down the station, and fired Bob Marshall on the spot. Because he said, "I told you never to play Beter again." It might have been when we were doing it the year before an International Connection, some Beter thing Adam didn't like, sounded anti-Semitic, so he backed off from Beter, so we weren't allowed to do him anymore. We either forgot about it or it didn't matter, and so he came down and disciplined Bob Marshall. So we were off the air for a month. Then Adam quits. He resigns as station manager. It was planned in the first week or so of June 87. And so I want to see who the new station manager is. We're not really part of the station anymore. So I go to there, and that's when Putnam Kozel was introduced as the new station manager. And at that meeting, Mike Dyer, now a little side thing, Mike Dyer came up to me in the record peddler when it was opposite Maple Leaf Gardens. I don't know if you guys know about that phase. It then moved to Yonge Street and then out in Queen Street West. But I was in there one day in 85 with Bob Marshall, and he came up to me and said he liked the May Brussels stuff and he was willing to play it on his show Friday night. He had the whole overnight show. So we said, great. So Mike would play May Brussels every Friday night going into Saturday morning. Might have done it for, let's say, 85 to 86, about a year. And he built an audience, people, fans of Mae Brussels. And there were a couple of girl bands and other bands that would phone in, and they liked the Mae Brussels stuff. And that Mike liked that because he was on the scene and he liked having hip bands listening to his show. So that was Mike Dyer. So now that's 85 into 86 or so. And then Mike maybe switched to another slot and he didn't have Friday night anymore. So there it is in June 87. He asked me if I knew about the Church of Subgenius, and I said, sure I did. And he said he's playing their cassettes, and maybe he had heard about something, because I don't know why he asked me. But he asked me, and I said yes, and then eventually I told him I inspired it. And he said, okay, so you're the real Bob Dodge, why don't you come on my show, which was on in the afternoon, Wednesday afternoon, 3 to 6 or something. And so I came on June 17th, 1987, and you can hear that on the timeline, the recording of me first presenting myself. And Mike liked it. What we do, we would play a lot of Church Subgenius. I think it was a half-hour slot. Play 10 minutes of Church Subgenius, then I get to talk for 10 minutes, and then 10 more minutes of Church Subgenius. So he was still playing a lot of Stang's radio show. because he was into it, into the Church of Jesus. I was just curiosity. But the show went well, so he asked me back 2 weeks later. So I did another one, and he liked that. Then we're getting into Harmonic Convergence in August 16, 17, 1987. And I did the show just before that. I called it Harmonic Bobvergence and did all this funny punning. And Bruce, the jazz programmer, came down. And he was thumbs up. He loved the way we were doing it, and he was laughing. So Mike realized that he had a live one on hand, so I just came down every 2 weeks. And we did that from June 17th, I think it was the first show, 87, to April 88. And the second last show, or the last show, I think we ended on Hitler's birthday, April 20th. So the April 13th show, it's on the timeline, we had Stang on. And me and Stang had a showdown. And Mike, he was still like the Church Sub Genius, but then he had moved to the evenings, the midnight slot on Wednesday. So he said, we're not doing the afternoon, so don't come down anymore. And I'll see how it goes at midnight, and maybe you'll come on the midnight show. So he did his show for a couple months, and then I came on, I think, in that segment, that section is June 29th, 88, I think, is my first midnight show with Mike. And he wouldn't have me on the whole 2 hours. He had 12 to 2, and he would play a little Stang and stuff, and then I'd talk. So as we, maybe, I don't know, I don't know if it happened in the afternoon show, but the midnight show, pretty quickly, we started playing no Stang. I was too good, too interesting, and everybody was into talking to me. So we opened the phones at the latter phases of the afternoon slot. So now we were full. That was a new dimension. Not many people were taking calls, but it worked with me. So in the midnight version, going into the summer of 88, we had a lot of calls, and it became a really amazing show. And so Mike and I did it for till he quit in early February 91 because he moved out to the country. And he had married Philly Markowitz, who was a programmer at CKLM in 89. And so he just couldn't do it in 91, end of February. So I was scheduled for March 8th. And I got a call from Josie, whatever her last name was. She had a column in I Magazine or Now. She became an entrepreneur of evenings in the clubs or something, I think more in the gay community. She calls me up on March 8th, which is the next Wednesday when I should be on, and says it's International Women's Day, so we're not having any non-women programming, so you're canceled. And I said, well, I don't know what I said, because I didn't have anybody to go on with. I tried to get Brad Reed interested, and see, I had to be the guest on someone's show. Brad Reed didn't want to do it. So I said to her, well, okay, well, we'll come back 2 weeks. And I was pretending that someone would have me on. She said, no, Bob, you're finished. We don't want you back. So that was the end of the Wednesday night thing. But Wayne Morris got in touch with me. He took over from Mike on Wednesday night. And Wayne said, I want to have you on because I like what you and Mike did. So I did. So I'm back on despite the Women's Caucus or whatever they were, you know, banning me. I think someone saw me as a macho male thing because of J.R. Bob Dobbs. So April, May, June, July, and August. 5 months. Once a month, I come down and go on Wayne's Midnight Show and play big chunks of the Evergreens. And then Wayne and I would talk about it and we'd take calls. So I presented five lots of Evergreens archives for the first time on CKLN. I did a little fragments here and there in 89, 90, but I was satisfied getting that stuff out there on the record and felt completed by August 91. And then that was the end of my life at CKLN. And I organized Fatty Communion, the book, in the fall, got it printed in a vanity press in January 92, made 500 copies. And that was souvenirs for people who were interested, whoever listened. Now, in September 91, I'd finished the first week of August, Mike Dyer came in and subbed in for somebody. He had a Friday show. Now, Jerry Fialka was staying with me, you know, Zappa's guy. Zappa's employee, main employee, or one of the main ones. And so Mike wanted to talk to Jerry, so he said, why don't you and Jerry come down and go on the show? And I said, well, I'm not going on as Bob Dobbs because they banned me. I'm over. I can't do that. But I can come down as another name. So I said, I'm going to come on as Bob Neverett, Bob Dobbs' chartered accountant. So there it is. I think it's on the timeline. Me using the name Bob Neverett in 1991, September 91. I had it in my back pocket as a backup name. And then it was put on the chart 4 years later in 95. And then when James Martinez wanted me on his cash flow in January 2008, I said, the Bob Dobbs thing is too controversial. You'll get hate mail and all this stuff. So let me come on as Bob Neverett. So I retrieved Bob Neverett from 91, so that's 17 years later. And but it was on my chart, if you observed it. And so I started doing his show as Bob Neverett. And then Ion showed up a year later, and then we were doing shows, and I was known as Bob Neverett. So that's how Bob Neverett got linked in with Ion rather than Bob Dobbs. And that's how I got into CKLN.
Yes.
What?
That was the Church of the Subgenius. Is that like a ridiculous waste of time, like cult, or did they actually make some money with that, or like what went on with that?
Do you know anything about it?
Yeah, like I know I've seen that weird commercial with the Reverend Stang on MTV.
Right,
and
right.
I'm like, this seems pretty scary, actually. This guy's just yelling, and there's like lightning going around.
Well, it's silly to think it's scary, but
profit they turn on it or anything, but it's definitely still going.
Okay, so the Church of Genius was a very neat, avant-garde, hip comic book spin-off interpretation of their encounter with me and about my father. Because it's all about X Day, July 5th, 1998, when the X's come and one-third of humanity is saved, that's the subgenius, and two-thirds of humanity, the Pinks or the Wad, were killed. It's much like Ion's scenario, that this great die-off is going to happen. And the Ionettes will not die. So my father had died on July 5th, 1976. So 22 years later, it was July 5th, 1998. They used the 22 factor and my father's date and were thinking of me, but they couldn't have a picture of me. That'd be blasphemous or illegal. So they got a fake picture that approximated the picture I showed them of my father. And he looks exactly like the J.R. Bob Dobbs, and you can see it on Dobbstown.com where the image is flipping back and forth. Chad did this, I think, of my father's photo and the J.R. Bob Dobbs.
Yeah, there's a resemblance there.
What?
There is a resemblance there.
Yeah, now, the Church of Genius is an important art form in the long run because they predicted E.T. contact through me. Well, that's Ion. Ion is equal to any E.T. contact because people fantasize E.T.s will give us stuff, you know, new technologies and all that. Well, that's what Ion's doing. And nobody else has ever done that, known, really, unless you go into esoteric history and you believe that, you know, technology was given to the Egyptians and to every major civilization.
That's interesting that the whole paradigm of technology being given by E.T.s tends to be either placed thousands of years past, or if it's more recent, it's generally thought of more as a like saucer retrieval reverse engineering thing than like, I mean, I'm sure there are people out there who claim that, you know, aliens have been giving us technology, but they're not, they don't get a lot of traction as far as I know. Generally, like in the ufology world, it's all about reverse engineering crashed saucers and not really about giving.
Right, it's
unless that is the giving.
Well, it's like, what is that reverse? It's something like, you know, Philip somebody, that guy who wrote that book.
Corso?
Yeah, he popularized, and he was even on the committee investigating or representing the Warren Commission at JFK, some military guy who had some establishment cloak, and because he just claimed that the whole digital world was given to us by ETs. So who's doing the reverse engineering? The scientists, the stuff's given to us, then they reverse engineer and look back how it was made and then they make something else. Well, how does that concept go?
Well, I mean, with, I haven't read Corso's book. I've read like Randy Coppang's articles.
Randy, I know Randy.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I really like that, you know, one of the people who's, you know, in the ufological world talking about that. It's like, you can just reading his stuff, he's steeped in the McLuhan, and he had Zanocrony.com, like he knows about your stuff, too. And like
Zanocrony.com was not Randy.
Or .net or something.
No, that was Scott Norris.
Oh, okay. Well,
no, Randy. What?
Another round?
No, we're gonna have some food.
Yeah, I get you.
Oh yeah.
Okay, what do we got here?
Angus sliders look interesting.
Oh, do you want a couple minutes to take a look? I have lots of look.
Yeah.
Too many to start. It's time.
Yeah. So, let me just finish this point. So Randy meets Jerry Fialka, and then I meet Randy in the mid '90s, and he was very involved with the UFO normal cliche interpretations. So then I started telling about McLuhan and all this stuff in a different way to look at it. And he was smart enough to appreciate it. So he started taking the Bob message into the UFO community, got nowhere, but he started to interview me and publish it different places. He wasn't an internet savvy guy. So then when he published some of these interviews, I looked at him and he was changing what I was saying. He would put in ridiculous long words.
You mentioned something about that to me.
I've told you that, yeah. And so I said, you know, you're not interviewing me again. So I had a problem with the way he was taking this stuff. I mean, it was ridiculous what he would add into it, his own concepts. And but he went on, continued doing research, and I think he wrote a couple of articles for Paranoia.
He has a book called Camouflage Through Limited Disclosure. It's basically all about what Corso says.
Right.
Like, the disclosure is the cover-up, and the cover-up is...
So what is the reversing? If reversing, who's doing the reversing? The aliens or scientists?
No, the human scientists. Because it's an interesting idea that I had thought about this for a while before, that this idea of, just taking at face value, at least, assuming that it's true that some kind of saucer crashed in Roswell or whatever, whether it did.
So the human scientists look at the crash stuff and they reverse trying
like
to figure it out.
Rather than being deliberately like, here humans, here is the technology, that it could almost even be like, well, you know, for the human's own psychological sake, it would really be better for them that rather than us paternalistically giving them the technology, if we pretend to crash so that they can then figure it out for themselves with their back engineering or reverse engineering.
Okay. So the human scientists do it. I was familiar with that concept years ago, but I haven't thought about it because we have ion giving us stuff. Now, the Evereen said the prime directive on one of those TV shows, Star Trek or something, is that the aliens would never help a society. They're not allowed to. Ion, and the Evereen said that's the exact opposite of what it really is. They want to help and they try to, but humans aren't interested in a lot of cases, or they don't understand what's being given to them, what's the context for it. So let's flip that, forget the reverse engineering, it's given to us. And so ion comes along and gives us our stuff and has no qualms about it. Maybe is difficult in explaining it in our scientific context, plays games, mind games about, we have to work at it to figure out what the verbal concepts about what it is are. But ion's always trying to frustrate the mind anyways, because it's usually going to make a mistake and be a weak thing to rely on. So there is the agenda of ion trying to get people out of their mind bias, and that may explain why he gives us stuff and then doesn't explain it properly. So we're not too impressed with Hawking, but he is in a weird panic statement kind of thing that you're noticing.
Yeah.
I mean, ion just comes up with a price and can explain it, and it's not as complicated as the physicists make it. You have to believe in you have to believe there's that you're eternal and that non-physical is pretty interesting phenomenon. It's not everything. The physical is more important. You have to believe that, and many people wouldn't believe that. They don't want to commit themselves that there is life after death or life before death. They can't make it. So ion says that's okay, doesn't matter to ion, but ion's here to enhance those that can respond to that assumption.
Okay, mango.
you.
Malibu.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pepper, you have everything you need there. Looks good.
Yep.
Yeah, enjoy
it. It's pretty neat talking to Ion and having this ET contact and having this stuff given to us with, you know, with a smart science mind like Carolyn. Then I'm pretty good at, Carolyn will go along with what, using what she knows, and that'll evoke a certain amount. Then all of a sudden I'll go, so time is backwards and staying is wrong. Sort of jokingly, a ridiculous statement.
Yeah.
Or McLuhan's point, and Ion goes, very good, that's actually hard, that is actually appropriate. And then Carol will find maybe that doesn't fit science, so she's got to figure out what the hell I leaped accidentally into, and then I have to figure it out. So it's constantly going back to her left hemisphere and my right hemisphere intuition, which is many times I'll say the most avant-garde thing that has no proof, and it's exactly what I'm trying to get to. So we are a pretty good team in getting to understand what Ion's doing, because you have to think ridiculously beyond science, but Carol doesn't do it that way. She has to work through the concepts that she's used to working with, and then she's ready for the new stuff, and once I make a leap and Ion agrees with it, she thinks about it, she says, oh, okay, she accepts it. So it's a very interesting duo thing. I'm very happy with how our minds are appropriately responding to Ion, and Ion compliments us. And but you have to have it two ways. If I leap ahead too soon, I will bat it down, and we have to wait for Carol to go the step by step route and end it up in the same place. We got, you know, hundreds of hours of doing this, and I played some of it through the past couple of years. I played excerpts from those sessions. Like chromosome 14 is a big deal. Is there any dressing? Is there any dressing you put on this? I guess not. So, chromosome 14 is a real key factor. It seems to be the interface between physical and non-physical. So the ISA has non-physical aspects that science can't see. But when you have 2 hurricanes coming toward Maui, and one's called the ISA, called ISAL, the other one's called Julio or something, and then I'm up in Switzerland in the mountains at a place called Sati. And right beside it is a little village called Isel, the same spelling. So this Isel reality is coming at Maui, and then you have the same time you got the Al Qaeda guys or ISIS saying Isil, ISIL.
Yeah. This they changed their name, exactly.
Right. This is the xenocrony that we create in the Android Means language on the level the word makes a market. They're mirroring us.
It's interesting because, I mean, this question, did they change their name, or is it just, it seemed like, because Obama still says Israel, with the, and the Levant, rather than and Syria, it seems like
But they did call them ISIS originally,
certain media cabal has decided for their own superstitious reasons to name them after ISIS, like, was it the group themselves that said, call us ISIS, like, or?
I say that's Android mean confusion to distract from us, you know? Let me tell you, I want to hear something awesome, the hidden ground of this summer. So, you have that Malaysian plane disappear in the spring.
That was
been a long time.
Yeah, not the second one, it was the first one. And Ion said that.
Oh, yeah, that was in the spring, yeah, the first one, yeah.
And that ended up in the parallel Hanoi.
Right.
And that was one thing, and that was due to the interface with Maybank in Kuala Lumpur, and you had that IBM guy on there, but nobody knew why he was there. That would be interfacing with the parallel world economy that China is involved with, in other quadrillion years, and that involved Maybank and up in Hanoi. So that's the first one. The second one, a couple months later, must have happened in August.
No, it was July, yeah. Yeah, it was July.
So they're okay so far?
Yeah,
it really is fantastic.
Good. So, you have the headline that this plane has 25 top experts on AIDS.
They're going to the conference in Malaysia, I guess.
Yeah,
or Australia.
No, Melbourne.
Yeah. But they're on in Air Malaysia.
Now, you haven't heard me talk about this on the show. You didn't hear the August 31st show, so you don't know what I'm going to say. You don't know.
Maybe. I heard some of it.
Oh, okay. So these 25 guys are killed because someone knocked out the plane, supposedly, right? So Ian starts to tell Carol and I what happened from Ian's point of view, or what really happened, depending how much you accept Ian. What happened is that there were two factions among the AIDS experts. One had a cure or a treatment that treated this baby successfully, and they were going to announce it in Melbourne. But a week before the Melbourne thing, the baby got AIDS again, came back. So that threw their victory out the window. Now, you had the other faction that was having great results, because they were using the RNA drops. And they got the RNA drops through a university connection that involved JW.
Did they know them as the RNA drops, or did they know them as something else?
They didn't know about
mystery substance X.
They heard about it, got a sample, and started working with it. They didn't know what it was or where it came from. I mean, this is the virtual class. They're living in their scientific bubble. Mm-hmm. And they're not listening to James Martinez and Cash Floss, you know what I mean? I don't even know such a network even exists. So they find this substance comes into their awareness. They find it is really successful with AIDS. So they're going to announce it at Melbourne. Mm-hmm. So Ian says that Ian was not going to have this. It's Bob and Carolyn's baby, and these other arrogant guys are, they announce it, and then they might screw it up in other ways. So Ion had to stop it. This is what Ion's telling us.
Wow.
So Ion arranged for another plane to be up there, and took the actual plane they were on and put him into a parallel Beijing. So they land in China for whatever confused reasons they thought were going on. So they call Melbourne to tell them, hey, we're late. We're not going to make it till maybe tomorrow or something. But nobody answers the phone in Melbourne. They can't get to anybody. And they don't understand why that's happening. And meanwhile, as a cover, I can't remember it now, but he told me where he got the plane from. He got an old plane and blew it up over Ukraine. So it looked like Putin or the rebels shot it down. Remember, that was part of the story. Meanwhile, some of the
conspiracy is that it was actually the Ukrainians.
Right.
Conspiracy theory or whatever.
Well, there's all these holes in the front of the plane, and the question is whether that's like, I mean, I thought that a missile hits the plane and blows up, but apparently the idea is that the missile explodes near the plane. That's why it's full of all the shrapnel that looks like machine gun fire. Some international observer pointed this out, that it looks more like it was shot down with a machine gun from like a neighbor plane.
Yeah. Those old planes that used to have the guns on, yeah.
So it turns out Ian blew up the plane, and it's considered a summer turmoil because one of the debris landed into the Gaza Strip, which caused Israel and Gaza to go at each other. I don't remember exactly what the debris did, because I was traveling during this and getting ready to travel, so I wasn't, just heard it and we reported it. It's on, I think I explained it in the unrecorded Bill show.
Oh.
It wasn't said.
Yeah.
In the recorded part. So,
yeah, you didn't hear all those details.
Yeah, these details are not familiar to you, right? So, I am selling me and Carolyn this, and we have to decide whether we're going to do it, say it, but we decide not to. I said, no, don't talk about this.
Yeah.
So some debris caused a problem in the Gaza between Israel and the Palestinians. So that you had that flare up there, you had the Ukraine flare up, and people watching the news started to get worried, you know, panicking. So what really happened is that the 25 researchers are now in China, and they're told that their work is very important, and you're going to have to do some more research in this area. So it's like they've been hired to go stealth and work on a black op project. That's how their altered situation, not getting to Melbourne, is explained to them. What it really was Ion just aborting them announcing the RNA drop substance at the thing and then making claims, and then they've treated it and they're wonderful, and there's no knowledge of where it really came from. So Ion puts us at the center of it, of this whole summer of turmoil, and who the hell's going to believe that? So put it on record here for the archives, which might be understood in 20 years, but that's what Ion says is happening.
It is also weird that it's the same airline. And right. Then isn't that also where Ion says all the financial, all digital transactions go through Qualcomm?
The Maybank.
Yeah.
Well, that's actually why.
Even the Church of Subgenius pointed towards Malaysia back in the day, where they said Dobstown was.
Right.
Really? Dobstown is in Malaysia?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's part of the old, joke.
And that's 30 years ago, 1983, they said that. So that's where the artistic accidental accuracy of right hemisphere intuition comes through art. And Stang didn't know how right he was. Now, we're not in Malaysia, but you have Ion explaining Malaysia and the ship from the World Trade Center in 1902, Maybank. And you know, there's a TV series. I like 24. The first shot in 24 of the first episode of the first season is flying over the amazing Maybank structure in Kuala Lumpur. It begins right there.
Is that Twin Towers thing, the Petronas Towers, or it's a different?
I think it is. No, it's a weird double tower. Okay, right? It's a pretty amazing architecture.
Wow, and that's right at the beginning of 24. Right?
Yeah.
I've never seen that show. But
it's a great show. So I was watching 24 years. It started in late 2001, I think. I didn't watch it till 2009 or 10, but I knew about Kuala Lumpur at that point, so that's good. You watch it later, you know more, and you see the opening thing. And it's almost like the producers knew because they were talking to one of the JWs.
Big covert focus on Malaysia.
Now, I don't know if you know this, there are 12 JWs.
12.
Yeah.
I knew it was more than
five or six. We know nine. And we've got what they are in detail, but I won't explain 10, 11, 12. But one of them is very involved in Hollywood. He's known J.J. Abrams since 2000.
He's doing a lot of episodes or a lot of different series. It's like almost every series you can find that can
Ionic concept in there.
Have you seen this one, Leftovers?
I heard about it
recently. Yeah,
someone told me to watch
totally,
it.
It totally is. And it's like a big portion of the population that disappears one day.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and then everyone else is left over. Yeah.
And these writers are listening to our show because Ion is the most original source of new ideas, new scenarios in 50 years or something. Any smart guy.
Yeah, you don't have to believe it.
It's just there to
create wealth. That
that's way. Right. That's right. They just hear, oh, that's interesting. Then they do a little distorted version of it, present it to Abrams or somebody, and then it gets made. That's what these scriptwriters, screenwriters, these idea guys are supposed to do. Come up with new content.
Yeah, he's busy with Star Wars.
What do you mean? He's doing a new version?
Yeah, he's off Star Trek, and he's doing the sequel. They're actually doing sequels.
Yeah, it seems like this whole shift around of the Star Wars franchise being bought and stuff, it literally... It just seemed blatantly like this was done so that the same guy could do Star Trek and Star Wars, and that it would be that guy.
Yep.
And then there was this thing like people made a big deal out of Obama. He made some slip up where he confused Star Trek and Star Wars worlds. I was immediately like, that's not a slip up. That's all part of this knitting together of the Star Trek and Star Wars worlds.
Yeah,
part of the program. Mm.
So they're in production already. They brought back the whole original cast from the 70s.
Oh, yeah?
They're all going to be in it, yeah. They even Harrison Ford got injured on set. They had to delay it.
Still knew
his own
stunts
in the
70s. Yeah.
Are you as Trekkies and all that?
Yeah.
Not really. I mean, I kind of like Star Trek, but I wasn't.
He's still credited as producer, but he's out as director now. He's too busy with these.
Who?
These J.J. Abrams. Yeah. So he's not doing the next Star Trek, but I guess he's one of the producers. But I think he signed on to do all three. They're doing three more, and they're going to be Disney. Now, sorry, because George Lucas is out now. He sold it. A weird one.
So. Ion's interpretation is the most fun to listen to.
Yeah.
Because it always pushes the envelope. I mean, he announced the other day that the cup is empty. So when did the die-off happen?
Yeah, and then where are all the characters? Because think of how big it would have to have been of everyone that's ever lived. Like, it basically goes there. And then if it's empty, then where do they all go?
Well, they come back here, but is it...
Because they're not all in this
where
dimension.
Where are they? Are these the homeless guys? You know, who are these people? Where are they?
Yeah, you wouldn't think they're all in this dimension because think of... it's like there is a lot of people here, but there's not that many. It's like...
I said we couldn't have 7 billion people normally through our dicks. There had to be otherworldly people coming through, and a lot of them... are from other worlds and they're sending or came back from the guff. And there's all kinds of them on the planet. But they're just acting normal. If you start arguing with Ion, he has an answer for everything. So he can think faster. He can come up with stuff that you're not ready to refute because you don't have the data to refute. Maybe 2 weeks later you might.
Right.
So Ion is... This is the New Agers will think this is satanic intelligence. You know, that book you're reading.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see Ion verse like in a debate with a Christian.
I heard on Evan's show.
Oh, what happened on Evan's show? Huh.
In summer of 2009, go to the early Ionic broadcast. Before he was on Cash Flow.
One of those, huh?
There was always in LA a fundamentalist religion guy would call in. And he quoted the Bible. And then I would say something. Then the guy would quote something else in the Bible. Then I would then quote three parts of the Bible. And the guy would say, oh, well, I don't know what to say. I didn't know you knew the Bible. And that would block him a bit. Then I would start going on a rant and quote five other parts. In the end, he'd so outquote the fundamentalist guy that the guy would hang up.
Yeah.
Because we did the Revelation, 68 hours on the Book of Revelation. We then had postgraduate, what's called the rewrite thing. That is fucking incredible what Ion does in those things. He'll say, okay, you got this idea, what you sow is you reap. Well, actually, humans get it backwards. And he will go, cite, one after another, 13 parts of the Bible. If you're interested, you go and look it up, and you probably doesn't make any sense, and then you ask Ion, and then he explains it, makes it consistent. There's nothing as fast as Ion. So yeah, the fundamentalists all would run once they knew that I knew more than they did.
So when you think of the story of Jesus, there is a portion where it does seem like a suicide.
Yeah.
He's like so powerful that it's almost like he let it happen. So
there's three Jesuses, right, says I am. And the guy that we all supposedly worship is the third Jesus, the guy who's fucked it up. See, he went public. And most of the sending people answers would never tell you that they're sending. They don't show their powers. They keep themselves. This little man gets into a mob thing and they string you up or something.
Yep.
Unless you can escape to other dimensions. So,
there is a part where they're going to suffocate them. Crowds, yeah.
Say what?
There's like a part where they're like going to suffocate them just because they're like the crowds gather around them so many.
Right. So the third Jesus screwed up. Ion doesn't. The third Jesus did go on and release hell. And there's this whole theology around the end of hell. He did do that, and that was good. But he goes to the guff. But the first two Jesus are still alive. They never died.
That is one of the Benjamin Krem ones they talk about in this book.
That's an interesting point.
He said there's a guy, he's in the body of a 650-year-old Syrian man living in the Himalayan mountains.
One of Jesus is like up in Afghanistan, and another one's in Europe. And another person who lived forever is Abraham's wife, Sarah,
right.
Still around, and she listens to our show. Gordon Ion.
then is interested, because they know Ayn represents a major change
it's
in reality.
It's not Sarah that calls in, though, right? Because there is a Sarah that calls in. Yeah.
I don't call in.
And,
like, my new girlfriend is 1,000 years old.
And then Vlad, didn't he say that Vlad the Impaler is in a Turkish, like, a bar or something? He hangs out in a cave in
Turkey. Yeah, he's still alive. But he's limited to one world.
Right.
Now, so Sarah, Saint Germain, Ezekiel, maybe Elijah, they're all still alive. And Elijah showed, Ezekiel showed up in a rewrite. Now, we didn't know he was alive at that point. So I just thought Ezekiel's meme, memory, whatever you call the ghost, was just coming through. So I started criticizing Ezekiel because he was just, if we asked him something, he just quote part of his Bible. It was his book. So after a while I said, you're like a homeless guy I encountered in New York many times who just has this one note idea and just keeps saying it to you. And I'm saying, you're like that. And then he would just quote the Bible to me in response to that. He never left the script. Well, Ginny is a former pastor, really knows the Bible.
Yeah.
So after about an hour, 35 minutes or something of this, Ginny says, Bob, everything that Ezekiel's saying is right in the book of Ezekiel, word for word. You were just hearing the whole book of Ezekiel being said to you. Mm-hmm. And that was pretty interesting. So then later, a year or two later, we found out Ezekiel was still alive. So I said to Ayn, so that Ezekiel that came, that was a living person that came into the room. And Ayn said, yes. In other words, it wasn't a spirit, it was a guy walked into JW's home and spoke to us.
Wow.
And it was recorded. Another absurd scenario.
Yeah, when he says Michael Jackson is still on Earth in India or whatever.
And parallel worlds. First couple of years hung out in India because nobody would notice him there.
Now, did he figure out the secret or the way to live forever and then now he's planning on that, or is he...
That's a good question. If you can go to other worlds and think you're dead, so you haven't died, but you could die at some point. So I don't know if you, by definition, because you go to parallel worlds, that you have become eternal or actualized. In fact, remember, you're always eternal already anyways.
Right.
But you made yourself become a little person, and you think there's a drama going on where you're going to die. Ayn knew acted out. Ayn always made a big deal out of Lady Gaga. Now, she went to school on 91st Street, and that's where I would walk by that school every day. So here's his interaction with Lady Gaga that I didn't know. It didn't mean anything to me. These little girls with their little school pattern skirts on. But
it's like a private school?
Yeah. Huh. And right there on 91st and 5th. And it's interesting that I'm walking by it for years. Six years. And then we moved to City Island. But what happens is Lady Gaga decides to go solo. She was being an introductory band for tours. So she said, I'm not doing anymore. I'm just going to do my own thing. It's just me. She decided that on March 12th, 2009. March 18th, Ayn comes to it the same week.
Really?
So they rise the same week. So when I put myself megalomaniacally in the scenario, I was walking by and my non-physical was looking at her and her non-physical, and she would rise with Ayn. Yeah.
That was right when I called into the show and was talking, recapping the whole synchronicity storm with Colbert that I was talking about. It was March 12th, 2009, was exactly the date when it like came to a head or came to this new level where it was very, very deliberately like, okay, no more of this playing with the kind of synchronicity and whatever, but like actually wrote a joke that made no sense outside of the context of this kind of narrow-casted thing, and that was exactly March 12th.
Right, and you've talked about that. That's on record.
Yeah, so that's now a legendary date in the Lady Gaga story.
Yeah.
When she decided to go solo.
Her first solo concert was March 12th.
Oh, wow.
Now, you have to go back to when the video was released, because Ayn goes on about how her manager released the video without her knowing, and it went viral, and then all of a sudden she's famous.
And she ends up firing her manager for disobeying the contract or whatever. So Ian knows all those details, but I have to look it up exactly when that viral video went in relation to March 12th. So probably the video happened before that, and then that gave her the confidence to go solo.
She was here about a month ago.
Yeah.
She went to the, before a concert, she went to the Vapor Lounge, like there's the one on Yonge Street.
She went to what?
It's like a Vapor Lounge. It's a place where you can smoke weed, and they got like vaporizers there. So it's, instead of smoking, you use a vaporizer.
So that's what I was walking along, and I saw someone in a lawn here somewhere, smoking something, a tube.
Yeah, pipe, that could have been an electronic cigarette, too. They had like electronic cigarettes, or you could vaporize marijuana, too.
Oh. Well, so she went to that.
Either. Yeah. Yeah, so they got a few of them now in Toronto. I think they got even more in Vancouver. Probably Denver they got the most.
I thought it was funny that Vancouver got a Bitcoin ATM before Toronto did.
Yeah.
Toronto's the financial center.
Now we got the most of.
But Vancouver is the drug importing center, so of course they get the Bitcoin ATM.
No,
they just added, that was a conspiracy culture headline too, they just added like four more machines in Toronto, so now we've got
most,
yeah.
All right.
With the Bitcoin capital. Yeah.
Well, that's interesting, they might be trying to follow in the footsteps of Facebook. Toronto was the either first or like kind of last capital of Facebook, in terms of the most Facebook users in Toronto of any other city before it was totally like the world environment that everything was on.
So, you guys want any more, or do you want dessert? Have you had enough? You can order more stuff. That was pretty good.
I've had enough food. Yeah. I wouldn't mind another beer or something, but I'm full for food.
Yeah.
I'd probably go for another pint over a dessert, but I don't know.
So you can order anything you want. So
eating makes me need a smoke.
Well, don't smoke. You'll miss something here. You're interrupting the flow here. Sacrifice that shit for a minute. So, yes, you have to realize that in February 1993, when the World Trade Center was first bombed, it was because of that that the Chinese said, fuck this place. We're taking it over to Maybank in Kuala Lumpur. So that was the shift. So by 1995, you'll notice that China really takes off after 1995. It starts having highways, buildings, and everything going up. Now, I predicted to the Evergreens, somewhere there in the old days, that we'd have contact in mid-90s. And it would be on a space station up there, the Sovereign, whatever it's called. And so years later, I asked Ion, when I was talking about how the Chinese got ET technology, I said, when was it? And they said, mid-90s. And I said, well, that's when the Evergreens implied that the space station would happen. And I says, they were right. It goes into the details of what was going on in the space station and on the ground that made this happen. And the Chinese were given the opportunity to take advantage of it. And I am very impressed with the Chinese people. They're very detached. And Greg was telling me a funny story today. And when the North Koreans stayed at a Catholic place in the 1966 Olympics, he looked out and he saw all these humans impaled on crosses, and he was frightened. He said, what's doing this to people? Why is this horrifying image of a guy on a cross all over the place? He had no knowledge of Christianity. And so he saw it purely as these are horrifying images. Get me out of here. And he was in a Catholic dorm or something. Anyway, that's a side thing.
Yeah.
Interesting. But so Ion says and gives a little bit different scenario of what went on in the space station, not the general layout that the Evergreens, not the way they did. So we have that explanation of why China started taking off in 95 to now, because they had this extra computer software or something that I can't remember the details of. That if you look at China, the big busy highways in Beijing starts in the mid-90s. The whole world starts going there. You know, all the American Western business was
yeah.
had to go to China, so the word was probably out there.
China had something that they weren't talking about.
Yeah. Those ghost towns are a bit scary. Yeah. Those are, seem like a parallel dimension. It's a huge city that's empty.
Yeah. And they, so like they go nowhere. So maybe we're seeing other worlds.
Yeah.
Are they expecting a giant sudden influx of people to come from nowhere?
Yeah.
They're going to need somewhere for them to live.
Yeah, it's a good point. So the, okay, so my punchline is ET contact is better if you understand a Zion than any UFO that comes down and does this and that. Those guys die, unless they are advanced ETs that live for millions of years, and maybe they are. But they're just in a vehicle and they have this drama. Ion does it so simply, just says it and gives it. That's pretty interesting contact. So why not see Ion as the ET contact that everybody's wondering about, and it's predicted by the Church of Genius through me, and that's how it happened. See, so that's the beauty of the book of the Subgenius. Unwitting, just like James Joyce says, Mirza McMullen on page 254 describes McLuhan to a T, but James Joyce had no idea that he was writing that. Well, it's like the Church of Genius had no idea what the meaning of their writing was. And Brian's one of the few people who's monitored that and thought about it that way and critiqued them. It's just his PhD.
Yeah, I've kind of specialized in the Subgenius aspect of things.
See, what he did, he assumed that Bob was maybe a little more accurate than was given, and then that allowed him to look at the whole, their argument as fallacious and very weak. So what else do we go into?
So is it like the Subgenius is like it is a scheme that you got to send away for a membership or something, right?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, it's very important about the. I mean, if you can just find their book used somewhere without giving any money to them, you can maybe have a fantastic time reading the book. But they make it very clear that the kind of slack magic that they talk about, that you're not going to be able to really access that until you send money to them. And there is really something to be said for that in terms of like the what, you know, we use these the phrase like to buy to mean to believe something as well, and that's very kind of at the core of that, in the sense that, oh, you might think this idea is funny, you might think that this idea is half true, that the world runs, that slack is the most powerful force in the universe or whatever, but you're not going to be able to really tap into it until you make this gesture of putting your money where your mind is and your belief is and really buying into it, so that you can then have a monetary connection between you and Bob. And so yeah, it really ultimately does, you know, I mean, it works as a, you know, there's a certain just kind of satiric joke aspect to it, in the sense that it's supposedly just a satire on religion, and so for their argument to always resolve around to, so send $30 to this address, you know, is, it's also just an appropriate thing about how ultimately religion comes down to, you know, support us in a, you know, physical way here and now, so we can keep telling you this bullshit that you're getting high on. But you know, so that satirically, it's a good little mechanism. But they also, they seem at least to be quite serious about the kind of magic aspect of it, that it's when you send the money is when you can plug into the magic. But then of course that would be what you say. So, but I mean, like, Church of Subgenius, there's some very profound stuff going on there, which is why it's been such a cognitively dissonant experience for me over the years to encounter these people on the internet, and finding that they, the extent to which they seem to embody the good and interesting, exciting parts of that are dwindling, and that they seem much more preoccupied with just
becoming an appendage to a very conservative kind of Penn and Teller sort of skepticism, and then they end up becoming way more defined than they would like to think by being anti this guy.
Yeah. One aspect I want to add, Stang years ago said, you asked how did they do? Well, he did sell 35,000 books by about the early 90s, and but he did come on in 2011, December 2011. I played it on Payday. It was cash flow back then. He's crying because he's not making any money, and it dwindled to nothing, and he's almost like I might have to get a job or something. But some people rallied, so he's limping along. But they did do well back in the 80s and 90s for a while. The internet killed them in the early 90s. They weren't getting any traction, but then someone came to him and told him, hey, you got to get on the internet, showed him how to do it, and then they started, and then their presence started to be retrieved. So they've had their ups and downs.
That's the Alt Slack.
Yeah, Alt Slack was the original forum. But it's not, hey, we're going to order some stuff, right?
Yeah.
So you're asking about the Church of Genius. It was very popular in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And then the internet, early years of the 90s, it disappeared, but then it came back on the internet, and a lot of that younger kids got into it. And then they started having divivals and traveling around. Then probably in 2000, it got weak again. I don't know if it ever recovered. But now, Stain jokes about the fact that nobody's listening to the show. And Lonesome Dave, who is the main guy he plays with, is sick.
Lonesome Dave.
Hmm? Yeah, he's sick, yeah. And I don't listen to many of the shows, but I've caught occasionally he doesn't make it every week or something. So Stain has to rely on his wife and playing stuff.
It seems like a coincidence of the Dave, though, just because his international connection had a lot of Daves.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of different Daves.
Yep.
The one that was surprised me, though, at the end of them was like, Steve Kellen was like on the downfall or whatever, was when you would call in and you would mention this guy, Dave Cooper.
Mm.
And then he ends up being one of the guys that's like a staff guy there, or like a guy that's always around, with a different type of name, but he's similar, I guess.
Yeah, I gave his real name.
Yeah. So like, how did that all happen? Did you actually know him from the CKLN days, or?
Greg told me all that stuff. Greg knew the behind the scenes of everything.
Yeah.
So I just, you know, hammed it up about it or something. But I wanted to say that we're talking about staying.
Did you
Oh yeah, nobody's listening. But that's because it's moved into Iron Dome and everybody's listening to us. A lot of parallel worlders, the elite, the this and that, and that's the he's just gonna die off and literally die if he doesn't get the drops. Oh, that's the idea of do it or get off the pot. What was that you were saying? Is that in the Church of Genius? Yeah, you had to connect with Bob. You had to send in your money.
Yeah.
Our version is you got to have the drops. Yeah. You got to get the drops and get that activated in you, or you're gone. That's the update of using your wallet and getting your $30 card.
Yeah. The with the
thing about their success kind of topping out. At a certain point, what I became interested in is that the way that they reached a certain level of subcultural penetration in the 80s in particular, and among the kinds of people who would tend to be the, not necessarily celebrities or whatever, but the kind of more grunt workers in the like comedy writing or script writing sort of world, or the kind of behind the scenes, because in a way the morality of it is kind of very conducive to a sort of some sort of philosophy of cool and like being, you know, not being too overly impressed by fame or something like that, that it ended up in a situation where even though like because a lot of the whole comedy thing, a lot of it is based on just referencing other things and making jokes about it, but the subgenus is something that has or does or has actually get a fair amount of reference that way, but because they never really penetrated to this super widely known thing, and you know, these days the in terms of a joke church, it's like the Flying Spaghetti Monster Church is the one that's known, and maybe Discordianism is a bit more well known than the subgenus or something. Because they never really penetrated to this total saturation, it still functions as just an in-joke, but there are places, or like one time, I know I mentioned this when I called into the show, but there was one line that stuck with me that Stang said, that he was talking about if they ever did get really, really famous, he said, the Simpsons would make fun of us instead of honoring us like they do. And it's true that like I have noticed a few different places where there's things that only make sense as a kind of a subgenius reference, like clearly some of the Simpsons people or Simpsons writers are fans, and they'll occasionally put in a little homage, whether it involves the name Bob or the word slack, or right. Sticking a pipe, having Homer suddenly pull out a mysterious pipe while he's floating in the air upside down, having a revelation in this weird moment of slack. So it's like that, to me, that became an interesting thing, because that became an anti-environment to the whole notion that's getting more and more and more. It's become like the main image of conspiracy theory or crazy Illuminati theorists or whatever is this kind of obsessive hinting in popular media, like a cult-based hinting of like, oh, there's this cult behind everything, and various symbols or various words or just some weird thing in a movie that doesn't otherwise make sense is actually a reference to this elite cult. That the whole I'm saying is that the subgenius in joking thing functions as a kind of an anti-environment to that, yeah. Or like a success of the Church of the Subgenius, where you get there is a real phenomenon of a hinting at a cult, but you know there's no core to it. It's like the missing fundamental or whatever. Like it's like the presumption with the Illuminati thing is that this refers to a real cult that's like committed real atrocities or has real power, and that's what it refers to. And that with the subgenius thing, it just comes down to a reference of it's a real joke, but it's just a joke that it ultimately doesn't, it comes down
and
to nothing. And in the new environment,
real.
The joke thing has more power than the real thing. That no matter how real the Illuminati references are, the idea of referring
more power,
to
them,
or more
power.
Currency or something,
yeah.
Or that those reference, or
because
that more likely to synergize with the synchronistic
because
effect.
Because the kids grow up in an environment where nothing's real,
right.
So you go with the thing that's always saying we're not real, and that
right.
becomes more real than the serious Alex Jones cult.
Yes.
Then we show up to smash all that apart because
yeah.
we're fucking real,
yeah, exactly.
And we're unbelievable,
to
so
provide,
we're both.
To provide a new both and.
Yeah, new both and. And the. Stang used to say to me, you don't know, I got connections all over the place. Now he was talking about. Mother's Bar, and his ad agency is getting a lot of contracts through the years, so he's got Mother's Bar, his ads are influencing the masses,
right.
Virgin Airlines or something. So he said there are people into this stuff, but then he gets depressed. He starts saying, you know, I missed a lot of opportunities, and we're actually forgotten now. So it oscillates between many hip people know about it, maybe stars, they know about it. Someone was telling me some cartoon had it lately in their little symbol, or a cartoon from 10 years ago. So he rides on that, and he thinks that I'm nowhere, and any of these Mother's Bar could, if I started to make it in Hollywood, Mother's Bar would stop me, you know what
right.
I mean? He didn't realize that we got JW, who's been influencing Hollywood for years, and Ion is, and big stars are into Ion, and all that stuff. You can't imagine that. See, so that's where they become little guys. They're clever little people, and they don't have the mind to get on the level that we're presenting.
they don't have the whatever it is, the confidence.
It's funny because, yeah, it does come down to not so much the mind in the sense of not super smart enough, but just it's more of just a slack enough or open-mindedness enough.
They're average working class people.
Yeah.
Or maybe a few upper middle class. He used to brag, well, I've got many sub-geniuses who are doctors or live guys who live off their doctor wives. He tried to lump me in with that stuff.
Yeah.
That wasn't the case. So, but there is a level of transcendence that the average sub-genius doesn't get to. He's too cynical. He's been damaged, you know.
Exactly.
Too cynical. Yeah.
That it's like, well, because what I was trying to just say is that it's like when you're saying that they don't have the mind for it, that's funny because it recapitulates the, like, it was right in the opening salvo of the new sub-genius book from a few, it's almost 10 years ago now, it's like 8 years ago, was so much for book smart, you know, that they're trying to draw this distinction between, like, book smart is book smart and that's fundamentally obsolete kind of smart, like, we're aimed at this more kind of raw smart or savvy of some kind, and yeah, it's interesting because it's not... when you're saying like they don't have the mind for it, it's not that you're saying like, oh, we're brilliant in a high IQ kind of way. It really has, they've just painted themselves into a corner of like where they're kind of smart is being too much identified with a cynicism.
Yeah, cynical, and that's what Croker predicts or describes. So they don't know, that's why they're in the Croker quadrant.
Yeah.
So actually my stuff is clinically accurate. For all the different phases I have on the chart that a psychologist, a new kind of psychologist, could use for their suburban parents' kids' problems. You know, they could slot it into different quadrants. But the so they're left. Actually, they don't make it into 21st century is what I say.
Yeah.
As many of the other old McLuhanites don't make it. I mean, I don't know if you make it or he makes it, but the... what we're doing, since you don't know what it is pretty astounding what's happened. And I like people who somehow intuit, oh, that's happening.
Yeah.
Like, they believe us, like Roxana. They're not dupes, they're smart, cynical people and all that, but they actually are happy saying, this actually is going to be pulled off.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's part of this, like, the self-limiting cynicism thing is that it's like ultimately believing their own bullshit too much about the idea that the only way that you could possibly have a receptive audience is that it would just be a function of people who are, you know, too stupid to question what they're being told by a liar.
Yeah.
You know, that it doesn't ultimately, it's not ultimately dependent on... I believe what this person is saying, it comes down to what this person is saying is resonating with me, and then you can kind of have a whole sub-drama of like, well, what's the difference between believing exactly what they say and how exactly does it line up with my raw knowledge, but when ultimately there's enough slack to perceive in a more raw sense that like, well, these are good people, and if it doesn't all line up perfectly, then, you know, sure, there's some friction there as well as frictionlessness, but...
yeah.
You know, that doesn't just come down to like, oh, you finally managed to get into a situation where you have a growing army of dupe zombies. Like,
no way.
No, it's
resonating.
You've got
9-year-old women calling up saying, hey, I got a boyfriend.
Yeah.
And that's not a dupe. That's someone really happy that their bodies are alive again.
Yeah.
So it's obviously, we're doing great stuff. And it's a limit, you're in trouble for... being happy in the 21st century if you block on that stuff for stupid old-fashioned reasons from the 80s.
Yeah, because they're an old-fashioned reason.
Yeah.
I mean, I keep getting stuck on their thinking about their side of things because I ultimately just too imprinted on the fact that in a lot of ways their propaganda is like thoroughly brilliant, and there's something
as a
about
young person, it's like the hit records that make you nostalgic.
Yeah,
you grew up,
but I mean, just even in it, and imprinted that way, but also just in that there really is something to slack and how they describe that as a, you know, I mean, to me, at a certain point, I was like, how come there's like.
the reason it was such a revelation for me encountering you was because I, on a satire sense, I wondered why, like, the Church of Subgenius should be something that should be a subject for McLuhan people.
Yes.
And, like, how come the Church of Subgenius doesn't seem to have any presence in the, like, Pomo philosophical thing? Because to me it always seemed like a profound philosophical breakthrough that of values of, like, that you know, slack rules, not these other categories. And so it's just they've managed to become their own kind of old-fashionedness where they're getting on the wrong side of slack.
Yeah.
And you and the relationship between you and your audience has more slack than the kind of nostalgic relations of them and their audience.
Yeah.
Like, it's just the irony is that slack is the word for it.
Right, and Frater realized this, Love Job now we call him, and went in there and said, you guys would improve your situation if you bring in purple stuff.
Yeah.
And of course they never do it, and it was funny how they played and yelled at him.
Yeah.
But he was actually right. That's what they require to do. They should get on the drops or something or try it out.
Yeah.
And then we had some interesting expressions of humor from them.
Yeah.
As they go, my fuck.
Friction mode, unfortunately.
Yeah. No, but it'd be funny.
Yeah.
You could just see them say, we hate to admit this, but I am feeling really good now on stupid Bob Dean's product, which is obviously snake oil, but I don't know how. It must be, like you were saying the other night, Bob must have made this as a joke on us to have the loser Bob Dean actually pull out something.
They attributed it to their own hallucination rather than to you. And it comes down to a situation where, like, they're wishing people ill, ultimately, because it's like they would prefer that all of your audience just be, you know, tragic dupes rather than that they're getting great slack, you know?
Yeah.
And
we know that's what's happening. So they lose. Would you say strangely...
strange and sad.
Yeah.
Their situation.
Yeah, in other words, they end up being the conditioned mind. The mind, as Ian says, is always resisting everything. They become the archetype of humorous but stubborn and screwed up resistance.
Yeah.
Which is the old way, the conservative way.
Yeah. Yeah, well, because they're left with nothing but, like, little flashes of their own brand of surrealism or something as humor, because it's like... Because of this massive resistance that's built up over the years, they can't remount any kind of a serious philosophical... They can't really provide a real answer for people anymore because there's just too much of this conflict between all the things that they've rejected as having too much to do with you, basically. Stuff that just stinks of you, like any kind of certain McLuhan things or Pomo things or LaRouche conspiracy things, like... That's just all a bunch of, like, demonism or something, so...
Yeah, and I could do lectures on the Book of Subgenius and show how there's a little bit of value in LaRouche in describing non-physical science, and a little bit of value in Thompson, a little bit in Croker, and McLuhan. I could do and show how their books... I mean, they do have a warp tetrad in there in the Book of the Subgenius. There are a few other things that you could bring out, and Stang would sit back and he'd have to marvel, holy shit, this stuff was bigger than we realized it was, or you could relate it to
their own stuff that
yeah.
they created.
This is uncanny, weird, that we made sense.
Yeah.
Like Phineas Wake does when McLuhan translates it.
Yeah.
So the influence of your father in this is, like, is the Church of Subgenius actually a parody of your actual father? Or?
No, he's a parody of Iandom. They're a parody of... I mean, and Ian knows this, and occasionally, I don't know if you ever heard Ian say this, he'll be talking a lot of this profound stuff to some scientist, and then he'll say, well, you'd have to see Reverend Stang for that part. He'll make a reference to Alt Slack and Reverend Stang, ironically, but the very fact that the second coming brings it up means they get a little credit, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So what, now ask your question again, say that again, what...
Like, your father, the only influence is just the image of Bob.
Yeah, yeah. They actually were influenced by me, but they couldn't use an image of me, so they used my father. My father is not Iandom, you know. He's like Old Testament. I say Zappa, Church Subgenius, maybe someone else I forgot, or John the Baptist for Iandom and Dobstown. They accidentally predicted it.
If you get to understand Ionic philosophy, you will see it's exactly the way the subgenies talk about morality or ethics or the compromised situation. It's pretty close in as much as one could write it. But that's mind. Ion says there's another level, that non-mind, that is like for the first time explained clearly, not just a Zen concept of non-mind. He actually tells you or shows you how it happens, and most people start having it. One of the common things is long-time Ionettes will miss a show for a few weeks, and then they'll listen 3 weeks later, catch up to something that happened 3 weeks before, and right when they're doing the dishes, Ion will say, Allison's doing the dishes. Now, it was said 3 weeks before, but she hears it 3 weeks later, and this uncanny timing is mind-boggling. The mind can't figure it out, but it happens to the Ionettes all the time, that Ion makes a message to them personally, and nobody notices at first until the person reports back a month later, hey, this happened last week. Well, how does this happen? How did Ion know? How did they know when I would listen to it, and then it would fit my reality? Now, that's pretty amazing musical composition. It's like what Zappa was trying to show with his complex rhythms. Yeah. And then the strange synchronizing that would happen among the band when nobody even knew what it was about. Yeah. So even though they knew their lines, so that's...
Those kinds of experiences are really interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, I associated that kind of not... I mean, I haven't had particularly experiences like that surrounding Ion, but... I definitely had a huge flood of those kind of experiences that, like, ultimately seem to refer back to you or kind of swirl around you in a way. Yeah, and with Five Body, and it's interesting because they're really those kinds of not. I mean, they definitely seem to go beyond classical simple synchronicity or something.
Yeah,
and particularly just really had a very kind of mind fucking or brain yoga kind of a sense, in that they were like a kind of a like you're saying, mind boggling, and the particular boggling would be like your mind is flashing over the kind of possible explanations for this kind of thing and just how absurd those things are.
Yeah.
And it's like a low level of that can certainly drive a person insane, in the sense that, you know, it can be very difficult to process or believe that that sort of thing can kind of just happen, or that it doesn't mean anything beyond what it seems to, or that there is a connection there. But, you know, then the alternative is thinking that these things are directly programmed somehow to try to be aimed at you, and you can get really paranoid that
way. The thought that Ion brings in is that, like I said, we're just a recording. That everything's already happened. Ion applies eternity to practical knowings. So in eternity, everything's already happened. And so Ion's always said every payday, they've already experienced it, so they know what's going to happen. So we're recordings, and the neutrino seems to be the particle that goes faster than the speed of light and brings in the, Ion says, is the substance of already recorded. So when you start thinking of that idea, you figure out how someone could sink in 3 weeks later with Ion, because it's already happened from Ion's point of view, so he knows when it's going to happen to you if you keep reminding yourself that it's already happened. So that factor most people don't think in. So this whole discussion tonight already happened, and whatever interesting patterns came out of it, we already did.
Well, one of the ways that I experienced a real super intense over years, and it hasn't stopped completely, but it's slowed down for the most part, barrage of these kind of intense synchronicities, and one of the ways I was able to kind of bracket out some of them anyway, or explain away, is with a kind of I don't know if Ion mentions Sheldrake and the morphic fields thing much, but some of it, especially the ones kind of synchronicities that wouldn't happen with like involving a movie or something, which would involve its own kind of set of like, and to think that this was obviously, you know, was written long ago and then came up and it's synced perfectly for now, even though it's so long in the making. And it would be a very different kind of thing when it was a TV show that was just recorded a couple hours before. But it would involve a kind of thing. I could bracket it out or explain it away by thinking that, okay, it's like you set yourself up to have a kind of an experience like that when you are when you're otherwise coming to some good realization and you're resonating with something true, and then your brain, in order to underline it to yourself and to emphasize that experience or that thought that you just had, you can kind of briefly tap into like the morphic field of people who have watched that movie before, so then you kind of know what's coming up. Well, yeah, you get into anomaly mode of some kind, but the idea that...
The brain has to make a statement, and all it can do is make an anomaly, which undermines the mind's effort to bring order in the old way, but that is showing there is order because the mind tries to show it, and it fits backwards into what you were excited about.
Just the fact of it being an astonishing matchup is order.
Yeah.
Order that has to contrast with the
that it arranges itself in a way that makes it clear that this was not any other kind of order that you previously knew of.
So and that is a description of my life interacting with Ion and before the xenochrony that happened in Five Body. So, you know, some of the INS go back to Five Body and they read Kigi and some of the complex stuff and they say, this is amazing, this it's like prefiguring the ionic reality, the effect of ion. So there was a working out for years of what was coming, but that's because we had already arrived at ion.
Yeah.
And so we didn't allow ourselves to know that, but we're acting as if ion's coming, and the Church of Genius throws it in there. I throw it in with my stuff, and Carolyn and other people. It's like goes backwards. We actually, Five Bodied happened after ion.
Well, I wanted to ask at some point, and so I'll kind of turn this question upside down and say a few things after it, of asking whether McLuhan, because I know he said only a few things here and there about LSD, which is kind of frustrating, because it seems like of all the things that have been said about it, I want that man's mind applied to that question more, but did he ever say like anything about UFOs?
Yeah, he did.
Because in the Jung idea of the UFOs as them being like a vision of the soul or whatever, but it seems more appropriate to see it as a vision of technology or a kind of future ultimate technology of some kind.
No, he did.
But that ties in because of the idea of like, for example, this thing of me finding this newspaper, the idea of the xenochrony or these complex synchronicities that involve the media in the way that or just particularly because it's and tailored to me because of this like communication dilemma I have with my old friend where it's like, you know, why is it so difficult for you to understand that narcissistic personality disorder is not a way of saying someone isn't an artist?
Yeah.
It's like the prerequisite for being an artist.
Yeah.
That's like my particular communication dilemma in my friend thing or whatever. The way that the xenochrony happens as it's like the Android meme or whatever being the media as a whole with extended by synchronicity.
Yeah.
So, like, the synchronicity factor, sorry, the user-friendliness of the media as a whole, like, the media as a whole made ultimately user-friendly by the synchronicity factor, where just the fact that this thing was printed that day is a little bit of a coincidence, but then the synchronicity enables it to, I don't even have to make any kind of an effort to encounter that media, it's put in my path,
right.
The perfect little fragment of that day's media that would be relevant to me. You know, that just this idea of there's some time, because, I don't know, I mean, the more interesting UFOlogists or whatever, they understand that the UFO phenomenon is not just some simple hardware problem, but that it's tied into the most basic kind of Jungian, like it kind of means everything somehow, or it's tied into everything. And there's definitely something about this whole ultimate user-friendliness of the media as a whole and a vision of that through synchronicity that is appropriate as well. But you're saying, because that's one of the things I'd like to go to the McLuhan Library and find out, is there anywhere that someone would have mentioned a UFO that I can find McLuhan's annotations about UFOs, or, you know, what he did say about that or
anything?
Well, he always talked about anti-gravity vehicles were inevitable,
right,
because it was acoustic space being retrieved after the visual space era of gravity.
Yeah.
And so Eric, or there was a program years ago in the 70s on CBC on pyramids, and either McLuhan or Eric makes a comment in it, but I heard Marshall talk about it other times in the seminars, is that the pyramids were built through magicians of acoustic space.
Yeah.
What, is it over? Can't we have any more?
No, we actually, we close at 11:30.
Oh, we gotta
go.
Yeah,
we're a quarter to one here.
Oh, well, thanks for letting us stay.
Oh, okay. I'm gonna put that in there for you. Really, all right. Sorry about that.
All right.
Thank you very much.
All right, so we gotta leave in a minute. So the, still got it going? So, so he says that pyramid thing was acoustic space. Now that's a dramatic, almost tactile interpretation of acoustic space by McLuhan, more than what people think acoustic space is.
Yeah.
So it can be an all-purpose term for the pre-literate guys could easily do this stuff because they weren't limited by visual space gravity.
Right. For people speculate about an actual sound-based technology.
Yeah. That's acoustic space.
Yeah.
And in War and Peace of Global Village, he has a picture of a computer printout, and he says, can you read this interplanetary message? So there is UFOs as the technical discarnate environments.
Yeah.
And then there's the anti-gravity, and there may be another place where he just in passing, like he says, electronics as ESP in the 50s, but there may be another point in there about ETs or anti-gravity. So it was included in the fantastic new tactile electric environment that people had no clue how fantastic it was, and UFOs would be a expression of the upsetting of visual space assumptions.
Because, yeah, in Jung's book, Flying Saucers, there's one segment on UFOs in dreams where he analyzes some UFOs in dreams, but I found reading that these particular dreams seem to be much more like they seemed like they needed reinterpreting from a McLuhan point of view, because they seem to be about media technologies or media environments and the new ones, that would be like the UFO would be the kind of default symbol to go to for a human perceiving in the raw. They're having a raw perception of the new media environment, translating it into a dream image.
And McLuhan thought it was natural that something LSD would have to show up to approximate the amazing new synesthesia and co-anesthesia of the tactile world, the electric tactile world. So it all these new bizarre phenomena made sense to him within his larger framework. So I'll go over and pay this.
Pass off the name Charles. Is that Charlie Houston?
He ran the store.
Okay, I don't know him as a redhead, but I know Charlie Huskin was at least involved with that store. And
yeah, that's his last name.
Okay, Huskin. I know his son.
The selfie? You're making it a selfie?
I walk across the Confederation Bridge in Prince Edward Island. That makes me somewhat noteworthy.
Yeah.
This guy's from Nova Scotia.
Who is? I lived in Nova Scotia.
I'm Prince Edward Island.
Cool.
No one's perfect.
Prince Edward Island was a Final Jeopardy answer recently.
It was the final place of Confederation.
Oh yeah, that makes sense.
And Julian James was a professor there. He did the origins. Yeah. Origins of the bicameral mind. Not too much. That's how you drive away. The mind.
You bring up some folklore.
Yeah. I was still glad. What can I say to drive this guy away? Julian James. You got a mind, buddy.
Yeah.
That'll fuck up everything. But the
I brought up Charlie Huskin because I know his son, and Steve Benwright is like close with him in that crowd and stuff. So.
Yeah, there used to be a picture of the store that Charlie brought Burroughs in.
It's all turkey.
And he was,
he's holding a baby. I know that guy.
Very, and like that's in the early '80s or something.
Yeah.
So Charlie met the Burroughs, and that would have influenced the Enright guys in some way. So, it's Huskins or something. That's the name that Dan said the other day.
Yeah. That's the guy. And yeah, he's the one who
still
said
around.
May
too
Brussels.
Bad that the Rosedale Library store had to close, but he's still kicking it.
Yeah,
yeah,
so
that's why Conspiracy Culture is one of the last independent bookstores left.
Yeah,
in the whole city.
I voted for it in the Now poll.
Yeah, what's interesting about that bookstore is that they got a lot of books because they only have one copy of a book. And they got millions of books in there. And you gotta keep looking.
Yeah, and I wanna go, I presume that they probably already have the new Imperial House May Brussels book.
He brought it up. I don't think they have it yet, but he mentioned,
cool.
Well, you weren't there.
I definitely wanna get that.
Yeah.
Well, it's a book about her?
Yeah.
It's a book of like a bunch of, I think it's about like two-thirds at least her writings.
Old material, yeah.
And then maybe a few things kind of about her, but...
By Alex Constantine.
Yeah.
Who tried to... Now, what's interesting, you got this battle between him and Dave Emery. It'll be interesting to see what Dave Emery says about the book.
Because
he doesn't like Alex Constantine.
Right. I remember seeing an Alex Constantine book that his focus seemed to be mind control.
Yeah, and being paranoid. I saw an interview with him. He had all his blinds shut in some California place to keep the people zapping him and keep him reflecting it.
And unfortunately, there seems to be, like, even these days within conspiracy theory world, there seems to be as you'd think, if there's anyone who could get past this idea, it would be conspiracy theorists. There seems to be a really unfortunate left-right division that creates very serious friction within that world. That's just, like, people, please, quit it with the left-right shit.
Yeah.
Good Lord. But I don't know, I mean, is Alex Constantine maybe a bit more right-leaning or something, and that might be the problem or something. But I was just reading that I have this fantastic reading on the way over here. This is very fun to read, the Steam Shovel Anthology. And I was just finishing up reading the interview with Sherman Skolnick that's in there. There's a great picture of Sherman in the middle part of the book.
Looks like Harvey Oswald on the cover.
Yeah, it is.
And Sherman was talking about how, like, he's like, I'm blacklisted among all these Kennedy researchers, and it's for no good reason, man, just because I was saying, like, look, I don't know anything. Here it is.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't know anything about Dealey Plaza. I'm not talking about the Dallas thing. I know about the Chicago thing. There was a Chicago plot. I'm talking about that. But it's like, there were, like, a few poison pen letters that went out about, like, Skolnick and May Brussels or Nazis or something, and I really felt for him. He's talking about, this is a fucking travesty that people are... I didn't do anything to deserve this bad reputation, and they're calling me a Nazi? Like, is it really this... Is everyone really that concerned about the particular individual politics of the writer exposing information?
I think what the issue is that you got literate people like Skolnick and May Brussels, and you've got these semi-literate, post-literate people who think in group mind. And you're talking about a big generational gap. Because they don't do the reading and research that Skolnick and May do.
If they're coming out of a kind of a hippie beat sensibility, then there's a half, like, tribal, assumed left-wing kind of thing. I understand that.
They don't do the reading of 10 newspapers and all that. Their articles are thin compared to a May Brussels situation. Yeah. So you have a dime media split there, a generational split. Because these guys are into name calling, and that's more later generations of the mind that goes into conspiracy. You'd have a more sophisticated kid of the later generations doesn't do that, but he's working for Apple or something. He's not writing in the fringe articles.
Yeah.
So it's actually, conspiracy is the last gasp of writing.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? Well, yeah, because it's like the individual, the possibility for the individual to know what's going on, like, you know. Well, a more fruitful split would be, rather than left-right, it would be male-female. I mean, there's more of a...
Yeah.
Well, when Adam Carfrey from Imperial House, when he first announced that he was coming out with the May Brussels book, and I had just learned that the woman that wrote another new book of his on chemtrails, harp, and the full-spectrum dominance of planet Earth, that this woman was the new, because Joan, like, sold paranoia or something to another group, and I didn't realize that this I only realized when she was on Coast to Coast, I didn't realize that this woman that wrote the Chemtrails book is like the new editor or publisher or something of Paranoia Magazine, of the new Paranoia Magazine.
Who was on Coast to Coast, Joan or this
no,
person?
No, Elena Freeland is her name, that wrote the Chemtrails book. And so I suggested to Adam Parfrey, like really on a, in a Facebook message, I said like, you should really think about coming out with an anthology of, because Joan came out with
of
women conspiracy writers, because Joan came out with a Paranoid Women Collect Their Thoughts anthology that I really enjoyed. It was really all over the place. Yeah, and it was really good. And I was, you know, suggesting to Adam that, like, trying to suggest very seriously, like, you know, it's possible that people could, at least for the length of time it takes to buy a book, people could be convinced that the thing that they're repelled by conspiracy theory is just the stench of balls.